June 28th Committee on Rules. As you can see, we have a fairly extensive agenda. As is our practice, we're going to take legislators first. We are hoping that we don't have the entire House of Representatives here this afternoon, because we had a lot of them here yesterday afternoon. And if real people have commitments elsewhere that are extremely important, please let us know and we'll try and get you up soon. For the lobby in the room, you know, good luck. You're on your own. Trying to think of anything else. And we do have a quorum, and with Senator Ringo, we actually could actually move something for a change. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
We're going to open a public hearing on 2507. Representative Greenlick, come on forward. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2507A requires a person conducting a wrecking business to deploy or remove any airbag containing sodium azide from the vehicle before the vehicle is wrecked or dismantled. I'm looking forward to finding out whether I pronounced that correctly.
Thank you.
You did exactly right.
Thank you.
I'm Mitch Greenlick, House Representative, House District 33, and thank you very much for hearing this bill. This is a very interesting bill that passed unanimously from the House Environment Committee and unanimously out of the House, 58-0. And it's interesting because it started as a bill to create a task force to figure out what to do with this product, sodium azide. I'll save you the very exciting 45-minute presentation that scientist Dr. Betterton made to the House Environment Committee. It was, in fact, a very fascinating committee at an earlier time in the but I will talk a little bit about it. Sodium azide is a fascinating product. It is the product that is the explosive in airbags, so that when a 12-volt charge goes across the back of an airbag, sodium azide, which is, I'm sure you're all interested, NaN3 from your chemistry days, a big explosive, it goes boom, the airbag opens up very quickly, and we're all saved of head-on collisions. It has a few other very interesting characteristics, however. It's a white powder. A teaspoon of it in a cup of coffee, which is enough to kill somebody. If it happens not to kill them, they show up in the emergency room looking like they have sodium cyanide poisoning. The treatment for sodium cyanide then kills them because it's exactly the wrong treatment. It's been known to happen in emergency rooms, and there is a literature on it because it is an extraordinarily powerful biocide. It means it kills everything. It's used in laboratories if you want to sterilize the whole laboratory. Its explosive characteristics are interesting as well. Two canisters of sodium azide is enough to take out a telephone exchange by just putting them together and blowing them up. And it has this third interesting characteristic when it's mixed with water in an acid medium, such as you can imagine crushing a car with battery acid in the rain. It turns into hydrozoic acid, which is a little bit more powerful as a gas than sarin is in terms of killing people. Now, we have hundreds of thousands and probably millions of airbag canisters around that have been taken out of cars but haven't been properly handled. It represents a real problem, and it's really quite simple to take care of this problem. All it requires is when a car is dismantled to deploy the airbag. Either deploy it in situ by putting a 12-volt charge across it, boom, the airbag is deployed and everything's taken care of, or by pulling it out of the car and putting it on a rack and doing the same thing, boom. It's probably a lot of fun to blow them. See what's going on, but it doesn't always happen. As I said, the first draft of 2507 was to get an interim committee to talk about how to deal with the problem. After the original informational hearing, we got that committee together, and in about 2 hours came to the simple conclusions of what we should do with this. And what you have in front of you is the engrossed version of House Bill 2507 that recommends three things. When an automobile is dismantled, the airbag should be deployed, and it should be deployed with immediately if it remains in the car, or if it is pulled out of the car, one of two things should happen. It should be deployed within 7 days, or it should be stored properly for resale. And there are some specialized recyclers that do sell airbags, and there are a few organizations that will reinstall undeployed airbags. It's a very tricky business, so there aren't very many that do. The only other thing we added in the bill came out of our consensus discussions, and it turns out that one of the people on the group had had both of the airbags stolen out of his car. And that came to understanding that there is a black market in used airbags. People are stealing them out of cars and selling them on the black market. And the other thing that we did with this bill was make possession of inappropriate possession of airbags also a misdemeanor. The bill in the House and continues to have everybody's support. It's supported by the auto recyclers. It's supported by the auto manufacturers, by the shredders. DEQ has offered to help the educational campaign that will go on. It has no fiscal with it, and it has no objection to it. And I hope you'll move it along to the Senate. Get it on the way to the governor.
Thank you, Representative Greenlight. Questions? Senator Shields, you don't have to ask a question.
Sure he doesn't. I don't have to give him a 45-minute answer.
Is there an alternative? Excuse me, maybe I wasn't listening closely.
Here's an alternative to sodium azide and airbags. There is an alternative to sodium airbags. It's a heated air process. It is being deployed on some of the cars. You know, it turned out at one time a car had one airbag and then a car had two airbags. Now it turns out things like Saabs and some other cars, BMWs, have 12 airbags in them. We are moving toward, there is going to be an international standard on airbags and on how to deal with the deployment of the sodium azide airbag. But there is maybe 20% of the new cars are being manufactured with airbags triggered by things other than sodium azide. So eventually we'll be out of it.
Okay. Thank you. That was a good question, Senator Shields.
Well, thank you.
Any other questions?
And a short answer.
That was most impressive, Representative Greenlight. All right. Any other questions? I think you're off the hook. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2507? Speak now or forever hold your peace. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2507. Open a work session on 2507. Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2507 to the Senate floor.
You move everything.
I know, but I, you know, want to make sure you guys are still awake.
With a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2507 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. There are no amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing that, so ordered.
That was a moving experience, Madam Chair.
Senator Shields, who would like to carry? Senator Ringo, did you want to carry it?
I'd be glad to.
Okay. All right, you guys. You're going to have to get very creative in your floor speeches. All right.
I did this morning, and you weren't listening.
I know. All right. Let's go back up to the top of the agenda. I'm going to open a work session on the House Bill 2050 for the purpose of possible reconsideration. I would move that we suspend the rules for the possible reconsideration of House Bill 2050. The purpose of rule suspension is for conflict amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I move that we reconsider the vote by which the committee sent House Bill 2050 to the vote with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Bill's now in back committee. Back in committee, I would move the -A7 amendments, purely conflict amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I would move House Bill 2050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Ringo.
Yes.
I think you were the original carrier. Let's let you hang on to that bill.
Fine.
All right, let's go back to public hearings and possible work sessions. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2247. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? And folks can bring up the sign-up sheet for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2247A requires manufactured dwelling parks and floating home mortgages to register with the Housing and Community Services Department.
All right, Ms. Schrock, Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Van Lanningham.
Number 2247.
Is it the same name as the character on West Wing? No.
Thank you, Chair Brown. My name is John Van Lanningham. I work for Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. I won't answer the chair's question. I represent low-income tenants. I'm appearing with Pat Schwach, who represents the Park Residents, Manufactured Housing Park Residents statewide organization, and Chuck Carpenter, who does the same for park landlords. We are part of the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition that negotiated this bill in 16 three-hour sessions in 2004 and 2005. This bill is the same as Senate Bill 636, which you heard, I can't remember when, and voted out in favor of. It only covers three issues: mandatory education for park owners, allowing park landlords to unilaterally install utility submeters, and removing local government restrictions on the length of occupancy of RVs in parks with lawful hookups. We hope that you'll support 2247, as you did with 636. We also hope that you will not amend 2247.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Schwach.
Yes. Schwach, Executive Director for Manufactured Homeowners. I think all I want to say is thank you for having a hearing on this, and let's hope that it goes to the floor and out.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carpenter.
Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. Just want to echo Pat Schwach's comments that we appreciate the committee having the hearing and the work session.
All right. Thank you. I will say just for the record that I believe Senate Bill 636 has come out of Senate Budget Committee, but we are concerned about time frame and so would like to go ahead and move forward on this particular measure. Any questions for the panel?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Does this bill have a fiscal?
There is a minimum fiscal, I believe, but the exact same measure went down to Senate budget and came back out, so I think we're in good shape.
So our intent is not to send this to budget?
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you.
You just caused Ms. Schrock to have a heart attack. All right.
Not again.
Anybody else wishing to have hearing or testify on House Bill 2247? All right, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2247 and open a work session on House Bill 2247.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
We have no amendments, do we?
That is correct.
And I move House Bill 2247 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2247 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Sarah Shields, would you like to carry?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's go into public hearing on House Bill 2340. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2340 authorizes the Board of Rural Fire Protection District to create fees for services provided by the district.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Oh, we have a panel. Ms. Ingram, Mr. Lesage, Mr. Blackmore, Mr. Armstrong. Okay, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Genoa Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association. I'll be very brief. Currently, the statutes are extremely unclear as to whether or not rural fire protection districts may, like cities, charge to recoup some of the costs of providing their services. There have been legal opinions on both sides of the issue. We actually asked legislative council whether or not fire protection districts could charge for their fees or charge to recoup their fees, and we were told by legislative council so long as it's in their charter. Rural fire protection districts, like other special districts, do not have charters. We just felt this only added to the confusion and felt that this area of law needed clarification. The bill, there was no opposition to the bill until it went to, just moments before it went for a vote, when it was discovered that the default penalty for local governments would be a $250 fine or 30 days in jail. There was some concern that we did not want individuals going to jail for failure to pay their rural fire protection districts. I gave my word that I would draft amendments unlinking the penalty portion of the law from this bill, which is, I believe, the note you have before you from Representative March. I have
Dash one amendments?
Yes. Just behind my testimony, there will be a note from Senator March indicating that they are now fine with the amendments. There's a lot more detail we could go into with regard to the bill. I did bring resources with me in case there are specific questions. However, this is something that we believe is a great need for the rural fire protection districts, and we would encourage you to pass the bill out.
All right. What else?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Blackmore. I'm an attorney. I represent Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'll be very brief. I intend to lay a foundation into record today and also answer any questions that you may have. The problem that we have is that the powers of governmental entity are those that are expressly granted or necessarily implied. And whether or not a power is implied is strictly construed against a governmental entity. And although a service may be mandated and may be required to provide that service, we are not necessarily granted with the implied authority to levy fees for it. There has been, as Genoa indicated, a difference of opinion between legal counsel on this issue, and we're not helped much through legislative counsel opinion. So the purpose here is to make sure that it's clarified that districts do have the authority. And just to point out, we are not a home rule entity like a county or a city. So there's a very different approach that we have in this proceeding. Thank you.
Sir.
I have no comment.
Okay.
Chair Brown, Ken Armstrong has asked me to say in the interest of time that the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association is in favor of the bill. It is a top priority for them as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Sir Shields? No, sir. Atkinson? Okay. I think... I guess, Ms. Ingram, the issue for me is sort of duplicative charging abilities or raising dollars abilities. For example, if you already have the dollars to provide X service, can you then, under this bill, impose a fee to bring in additional revenue?
Chair Brown, that was a concern on the House side, and we were successful in convincing Representative Butler that that is not the case. The districts that are charging now do not charge their own residents, because those residents are paying property taxes and other taxes that help support the district. What happens, though, is if there is an accident caused by individuals traveling through the district or they're involved, they want to be able to bill for those services for individuals living outside. The only time I'm aware of that the conversation came up where they would charge those within the district is, for example, in the area of inspections. And they see this as a safety measure where they will get called back 2, 3, 4, 5 times to inspect the same building. What I'm hearing from the fire service is if they could charge a small fee for the second and third time, they're hoping that that would encourage individuals to address whatever safety hazard exists and remove that hazard.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2340. The chair would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2340. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered, chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Who'd like to carry? Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry?
Sure.
All right.
Did you?
Dash
one?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to 2911, see if we can get. Okay. All right. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2911. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2911A increases threshold amounts municipal corporations other than counties or school districts can spend before the municipal corporation must obtain an annual audit and review.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Fields, Ms. Deister, Ms. Squires.
Senator Brown, I'm Chairman Brown. I'm Ray Fields of the McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District. I've distributed my testimony in a written form, but if it's okay with the chair, instead of referring to the McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District all the time, I will say either district or MRFPD through it to save a little bit of time, if you don't mind. And I did notice that since I wrote the testimony, there's been some changes occurred, and so in the last paragraph, in one of the paragraphs, you'll note that I'll skip over that. My name is Ray Fields, and I'm chairman of the McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District Board. The McMinnville Rural Fire Protection District is a unit of the local government managed by elected board of directors consisting of five citizens within the Rural Fire District. It was formed May 13, 1943 to provide fire protection to the rural area adjacent to the city of McMinnville, Oregon. The city furnishes fire protection services, fire prevention services, rescue services to the district on an annual contractual basis. Funding for this contract comes from the property taxes levied by the district on taxable property within the district as determined by the Yamhill County Assessor. Voters in the district approved the new tax base in the amount of $150,000 in the May 15, 1990 election. State law at the time permitted a 6% annual increase in the tax base, and the district's board anticipated with this annual increase revenues would continue to be sufficient to meet future contract costs. The passage of Ballot Measure 50 in 1997 substantially changed the funding picture for the district. Measure 50 directed a rollback of the assessed value of property in the rural district to 90% of the 1995-96 values. It's also set a permanent tax rate of 95.76 cents per thousand of assessed value. Finally, it limited the annual tax base increases to 3% plus the value of new construction within the rural district. After implementation of Ballot Measure 50, the Rural Fire District total revenues fell to a level below the level it had contracted with the City of McMinnville for provision of services. Rural Fire District voters approved an 18 cents per thousand 5-year optional serial levy in November 2002 election in order to bring revenues back to the level that was in keeping with the contract between the Rural Fire District and the City of McMinnville. For the first time, the Rural Fire District's combined revenues and expenses exceeded $500,000 in the fiscal year 2003-2004 by $37,469. Of this amount of combined revenue and expenditures, $26,900 of combined revenue and expenditures were directly attributable to a special countywide communications levy that was passed through to the City of McMinnville to offset costs involved in the purchase of communications equipment for the fire service. The end result is that the Rural Fire District's regular combined revenues and expenses exceeded $500,000 by $10,569. Regular combined revenues and expenses exceeded $500,000 by $10,569. Because of this, the Audits Division of the Secretary of State's office has informed the Rural Fire District that under interpretation of current statute, the Rural Fire District is now required to have an audit as opposed to a review. The end result is the Rural Fire District paid an additional $2,000 more than it would have had to pay if it had simply had a review. One question might be, is it worth the extra $2,000 to the taxpayers in the Rural Fire District to have an audit rather than a review, when it appears that the only difference between the two is a verification by the auditors that the bank accounts are what they are represented to be and the imposition of additional unnecessary paperwork? The Rural Fire District does not feel that this is a wise use of taxpayers' money. In addition, the Rural Fire District Board and its accountant do not believe that the existing statute should be interpreted to mean the sum of total revenues from all sources and the expenses for a particular fiscal year. We believe that it should be in either the total income or total expenses exceeds a certain amount, then an audit would be in order. It is for this reason that the Rural Fire District has requested amendments to Chapter 297. At the Rural Fire District's request, Representative Nelson introduced House Bill 2382, a bill that does essentially the same thing as this bill, House Bill 2911. It goes a lot farther in that it defines the terms audit and review. While House Bill 2382 did pass the Audits Committee of the House with an amendment and do pass recommendation, it's currently in an abyss in the Budget Committee, I understand, right now.
Ah, so bills in the House end up going to the committee as well.
Since House Bill 2911 accomplishes almost the same thing as House Bill 2382 would have, House Bill 2911 has passed the House, and I am here today to encourage the Senate to pass this bill as well. House Bill 2911 eliminates entirely the references to income and revenues and uses only the expenses to determine the threshold that would trigger an audit. It raises the threshold to $600,000 before requiring an audit, and passage of this bill will save the Rural Fire District at least $2,000 per year, or just a little under 1% of our total annual expenditures. I would ask, if it does not delay the passage of this bill, if it doesn't delay the passage of this bill, to change the effective date that's currently in there, the fiscal year beginning after passage of this bill, to the fiscal year beginning with 2004-2005. After all, I would like to save the taxpayers in my district the money this year instead of having to wait next year. If it makes sense for the next fiscal year, it certainly should make sense for this fiscal year, and we are only 2 days away from the end of this year, fiscal year. So perhaps if it doesn't hold things up, we could get an emergency clause tacked on to the end of it. And as I mentioned, there was one other significant difference in the two bills, which you might want to consider, and that was in under the current law, the term review and the term audit is not defined. And in House Bill 2382, there was a definition put in there, and it very simply says that in adopting the rule, it actually inserted a new section. It says the Secretary of State by rule shall define the terms audit and review, and in adopting the rule, the Secretary shall consider the definitions given these terms in generally accepted accounting principles adopted by recognized authoritative bodies such as the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, or their successors.
Okay.
And that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Dyster, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the League of Oregon Cities believes that increasing the audit threshold as described in 2911A will benefit the smallest of our cities while maintaining accountability, because it still does require a review, so we do support this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. In the interest of brevity, I will just indicate our support for the bill. We are thankful to have a hearing and hopeful work session on this bill, and are anxious to not have anything slow the bill down for the purposes of passage and speedy signage by the governor. Okay. Questions for the panel? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. One of the issues is raising the amount of the audits. The other one is removing from that threshold the receipts from all sources language, including money that's been borrowed. What's the policy reason for doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, or Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, we participated in a work group that met twice in the House, and that Senator or Representative Esquivel's, with Representative Esquivel's leadership. Our reasoning behind the removing of the receipts and going straight to the expenditures was we felt that the issue was really about whether or not the taxpayer dollar was being spent. Therefore, we decided to switch it just to expenditure instead of receipts because if the money was being received, it wasn't necessarily being expended. I really actually don't recall any discussion of the elimination of the language regarding the borrowing.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Sir, Ringo.
I don't know that I'm opposed to the bill. I'm probably fine with it, but I guess I'm not persuaded by the rationale that it will save the fire district money. I mean, we could save money by not doing any audits. And, of course, we don't think that's a good solution because we want audits to make sure that the funds are properly for.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I think, yeah, absolutely. And we don't want our municipal governments to not be audited. We're just asking for a modest increase in the inflationary index.
Well, why do we think these numbers are better than the numbers that currently exist in statute? Other than it'll save your fire district money, isn't it? Just because of where it falls.
The way the determination is made, Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, the way the determination is made now as to whether you have an audit or review is by combining both the revenue and the expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And what this does is just set the threshold at expenses only. So by just looking at the expenses, that's what does it. Otherwise, you're really looking at half the amount. Instead of looking at $500,000 or $600,000, you're looking at $300,000.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, if I could just add to this was a negotiated number that we arrived at on the part of all.
Who was negotiating from which direction then?
Well, the CPAs were involved, and I believe, I don't know if I'll let them speak for themselves, but they were part of that discussion, and the bill obviously did pass the House, so.
Madam Chair, just to follow up,
go ahead.
Who was arguing? Was somebody arguing for an even higher limit?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, actually, there was a discussion that took place that didn't actually deal with the limit issue. It was whether or not a rural fire protection district, such as Mr. Fields' district, if they are solely a contract district with a city, so all their funds come in, they don't do any. Pardon me. They don't do anything other than contract with. I know they provide a very essential service, but they don't provide actual service themselves. They contract everything out. That was sort of the crux of the issue that brought the issue to our association's attention, and that actually is not part of the bill.
I see. But Madam Chair, I'm just wondering who was at the table arguing for the need for regular and meaningful audits to protect the public. Was somebody in the negotiations representing that perspective?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that we don't want to reduce accountability for any of our districts. What we want to do is make it so that it's not a combined total, but just one or the other. These indexes had not been raised since 1977,
I see. And
the world is looking a lot different since then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time and energy, Mr. Fields. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2911. Let's go back up to the work session list. SJR 24, we're still waiting for amendments. Do we have amendments yet on 2113? Are those still coming? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. We're still waiting for amendments on 2113. I was going to move. Let's go to Senate Bill 1083. And I'm opening a work session simply for the purposes of moving this bill to the Revenue Committee. The chair would move Senate Bill 1083 to the Senate Revenue Committee where the merits can be fully discussed. Any discussion? Any objection? All right, hearing seeing none, so ordered. Thank you. Waiting for amendments in 2537. Let's move down to, does everybody have it? Okay. Will everybody check? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2113.
You should have in front of you the Dash A4 amendments. This bill came out of committee a couple of weeks ago. Senator Bruce Starr had some concerns on the Senate floor. I believe he worked with the Oregon Department of Transportation. They're fine. I believe Senator Starr is fine. We're getting lots of head nodding. That's a good thing. But these amendments do address Senator Starr's concerns. It's already back in committee. So open a work session. Chair would move the Dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2113. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move the bill as amended with the Dash A4 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Let's see, Senator Atkinson, you were carrying this bill. Do you still want to carry this, or should we give it to Senator Starr? Okay, we're going to let Senator Starr carry it. So you get for speaking out in this on the Senate floor. Thank you. Close the work session. Are we ready on 2800?
Yes.
Okay.
Martin.
Mr. Taylor in the room? All right. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2800. Mr. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we got?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for your patience as we got our ducks in a row on House Bill 2800. I would turn your attention to the Dash A6 and A7 amendments. Those are the two I'll be referring to.
We can recycle the fours and the fives.
Fours and the fives are not relevant to me.
Okay.
First thing I should say is that these amendments have all passed the scrutiny of the chief sponsor of the bill, Speaker Karen Minnis. They've also been signed off on by the majority office on the other side. House Bill 2800 had one concern as it moved through the House, and that one concern was a AG's opinion on a similar topic from 2001 that suggested that there may be some chance that what we were trying to do in creating committees that would establish the staffing plans for hospitals would be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act designed to protect workers from employer-dominated unions. The Dash A6 amendments have been composed with the efforts of the attorneys from both the Hospital Association and the Oregon Nurses Association, trying to make sure that this is bulletproof if it were ever challenged in court. We believe we've achieved that. For the record, I think it's very important to recognize that the committees being created to manage staffing are equally represented by management and frontline workers, so there isn't a domination issue. But these amendments go farther than that. They make it clear that these are essentially extensions of the management of the hospital and not part of a collective bargaining process. The committees themselves are agents of the hospital. And it's not the ONA's intention to create a new collective bargaining process through these committees. We are simply trying to facilitate decision-making around safe patient care issues that includes frontline workers and trust the hospitals to use that committee process correctly.
Okay.
The other thing that I should... you want me to pause?
Okay. No, you're fine.
Okay.
We're multitasking.
That's fine. I'm just wanting to make sure I wasn't plowing on. So that's all I'm going to say about the A6 amendments, unless there's other questions on that.
And I'm getting head nods from Bruce Bishop that the A6 are okay with the Hospitals Association. Okay.
House Bill 2800, A7 amendments are, in fact, the conclusion of some work on Senate Bill 450. Senate Bill 450 passed the Senate unanimously. The chief sponsor of that bill was Representative Dalto. It went to his committee. The committee closed before the bill came out. We continue to work with Representative Dalto until we found an agreement with him. These amendments represent that agreement. They've been cleared by Dalto, the Speaker, and the Majority Office. The change on this is a bill that really does address the issue of safe staffing. It requires that the circulating role in an operating room is performed by a nurse. That is, in fact, the standard for our hospitals in Oregon. We appreciate the fact that our Oregon hospitals often have a higher standard than hospitals in other states. This includes a variance that would allow some exceptions if, for some reason, a hospital wanted to use their operating room in an unusual way, and that variance was very important to some of the members on the House side, so it's now included in the bill. Any other questions on that?
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Taylor? All right. Anybody else wishing to testify briefly on the Dash A6 or the A7 amendments to House Bill 2800? Okay. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2800. Chair would move the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 2800. Discussion? Objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move the dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2800. Discussion? Objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended with the A6 and the A7s to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Would like to carry. Senator Shields, would you like to carry?
Okay.
Okay. We're going to give that to you to carry. Let's change that schedule. Let's go back up to the second page, start a public hearing and possible work session. Let's open a public hearing on 2429, revises provisions and increases bonding amount relating to operation of vehicle dismantling business.
She's popping her mouth.
No,
right. This is the vehicle.
I'm going all over the place because I was going to go into work session and I knew I didn't have a few votes and you left. It's okay. It's fine. This is totally fine. All right. I know. Ms. Crest, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Gallagher. If not, we'll find him. That's fine. He's got another committee, so. We'll find Mr. Gallagher before we close off testimony. Unless you absolutely need him here.
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah, we're okay.
All right.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Farioli committee members. For the record, my name is Barbara Crest. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Automotive Trades Association. Joining me in the audience today are Marianne Trout from Hillsboro Auto Wrecking and Mark Forkum, LKQ Auto Parts. I'm here to talk to you today about House Bill 2429A. House Bill 2429A will improve the licensing, record-keeping, and other state requirements currently in place for the auto dismantler industry. Just a few highlights of the bill for your information. The current auto wrecker certificate is now good for 3 years rather than just one, resulting in the streamlining of administrative time for both the auto dismantler group as well as Department of Motor Vehicles. There is no increase in fees for the auto dismantler license, currently at $150 annually and now $450 for 3 years. This bill requires auto dismantlers to hold a $10,000 bond, an increase from the current $2,000 bond, but still less than the $40,000 bond required for a vehicle dealer's license, which many auto dismantlers have as well. It defines the types of records regulators need to identify those that are dismantling vehicles illegally. For instance, it spells out specific record-keeping requirements by assigning a stock number to all vehicles and identifies major component parts sold by using the vehicle identification number. It allows for civil fines of up to $1,000 for violation and up to $5,000 for anyone operating an automotive dismantling business without a certificate. For your information, there are currently 269 auto wrecker certificates in the state of Oregon. When House Bill 2429 was brought up and discussed at a recent DMV Oregon Dealers Association meeting, there was unanimous support of the bill and no opposition voiced or noted within the group of auto dismantlers and auto dealers. House Bill 2429A in gross came out of the House Transportation Committee with a unanimous due pass recommendation to the House floor. The House strongly supported this bill with a 52 yay to no vote. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions you may have. Also want to introduce Bob Anderson, President of Northwest Automotive Trades Association, who would like to say a few things.
Go ahead, Mr. Anderson, and then we'll do questions.
Thank you very much. This won't take long. It's just bold print and it's double spaced. It has to do with a age and vision issue here.
We can all relate.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Anderson. I own an auto shop here in town and am currently the president of the Northwest Auto Trade Association. Thanks for finding a bit of time in your busy schedule this afternoon to hear our trade association's view of HB 2429A. The Northwest Auto Trade Association has long been known for its straightforward and practical application of cost-effective environmentally and sustainable practices within our own industry. We pilot the mercury switch replacement program. We've helped with the sodium azide bill. We also help the DEQ with the ecological business certification program interstate, and the list kind of goes on and on and on. But nonetheless, it's not our goal to try to force our corporate philosophy on any other many industries within our state. We're not environmentally to the left or the right on most environmental issues. We believe in practical application that's both fiscally and environmentally responsible. So needless to say, we're here today to ask for your support in passing HB 2429A. Environmentally sensitive issues, as you folks, you deal with them all the time, and I know I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, but they're difficult and they require decisions that are not straightforward many times. So with that said, HB 2429A appears to be one of the less complicated. The bill is brought forward by the same industry that it's designed to set standards in. Besides making good sense from an industry standpoint, 2429A contains the three other fundamentally basic components of all environmental decisions, which are economic, social, and environmental applications. So in other words, it fits well within our industry. Just one of the many factors that make this bill so important is the fact that helps set the stage in regards to how automobiles that have reached their end of life are recycled. As our industry moves forward to meet this, our country's ever-increasing transportation needs, these sorts of standards will become critically important to all of us. One of the biggest problems with environmental strategy is real-world application. In other words, practical application in the workplace is sometimes difficult to accomplish. 2429A simply requires the auto recyclers to adhere to their industry's best-known environmental practices. So, as we all search more and more for ways to reduce our transportation's environmental footprint, bills like this will help set a platform we can move forward from. Thank you. I can answer any questions if you might have them.
All right. Questions?
Senator
Ringo.
Who did you work with? It sounded like you worked with a group in drafting this legislation. Who was there?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, we work with this bill originally started in 2003, and the two people in the audience here today, Mark Forkham and Marianne Trout, are key people in the auto dismantler industry who began the discussion with a group of, I believe, 20 other dismantlers. When we brought the bill back this year, we used our Northwest Automotive Journal, did letters to all of these folks to let them know it was coming back, and in general, there was consensus on the bill.
Senator Ringo, any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your hard work. And we'll close the public hearing. Just wait to see if Gallagher wants to add anything before we move it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
2429. All right, let's just keep moving down the list. Let's go 2833.
10 and a half.
What? 10 and a half. Yeah, I'll save the excitement for the end. House Bill 2833. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2833 continues and modifies the authority of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee in Deschutes County to allow use of crime prevention funds for younger children.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Dye.
I'm Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Nelson, representing Deschutes County. Madam Chair, our part of the bill would allow Deschutes County to continue to work under a waiver that they've had since 1999 dealing with Senate Bill 555, Juvenile Crime Prevention Funds. We have been under that waiver since that time. This our portion of the bill simply extends that waiver and extends it only to Deschutes County. we think has worked very effectively there and dealing with children ages 0 to 8. We spend about 17% of the funds on that purpose and allows us to provide a crime prevention continuum, which we think works. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Sir. Madam Chair, whoever wants to go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. With me is Steve Dye, the director of Linn County. We are supportive of the bill, especially language that was amended in over in the House dealing with the juvenile counselor statutes. And to briefly explain that, I'll introduce Mr. Dye.
Mr. Dye, good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I promise to give my very best 30 seconds on this bill. Simply, what it does is clarify that a juvenile counselor is the same animal as a county juvenile probation officer. Throughout the code, it's referenced differently, and this is particularly important in ensuring that county juvenile probation officers have the rights and authority as a peace officer for those kids that are adjudicated and under their supervision. Thank you.
I'm well aware of the inconsistencies in the juvenile code, so we appreciate this clarification.
Thank you.
Questions?
Comment.
Sarah Shields.
Juvenile counselor, juvenile probation officer. The latter term gets the kids' attention quicker, doesn't it?
That's how some counties believe, yes. Linn County being one of those. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
That's okay.
Linn County, however, does prefer the term county juvenile probation officer. Since the adoption of the balanced approach, we believe it sends a better message.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, if what you're doing in Deschutes County is so good, why aren't we importing it elsewhere?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we tend to agree that our program is quite excellent. Maybe it's because we've had a lot more opportunity in the last 6 years to make that work. There has been considerable discussion by the juvenile directors, and it was felt that we should move forward with continuation of the Deschutes plan and let those other counties look at that and our success and evaluate that.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Ringo?
Mark, you spoke pretty quickly, and I don't know that I was absorbing it quite as fast as you were talking. But right now, I see in the statute that the committee, advisory committee, shall extend until June 30th, 2005, the waiver. This removes that section, so we're not extending the sunset. We're removing that sunset, aren't we? Is that what this does?
I'm sure, Senator Rago, that's correct.
And I guess, is that a policy decision that initially we had a sunset because we wanted to test the concept? We're satisfied that the concept works, so rather than extending the sunset, we want to let Deschutes County do this from here on out.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, that's correct.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, the sunset's extended to June 30th, 05. That's about 2 days from now. What happens if the governor doesn't sign this until this has an emergency clause, I assume?
Yes.
Okay. No, actually, it doesn't.
No,
it doesn't.
So what happens then between now and December
31, 05? Chair, Senator Ringo, that's a good question.
Mr. Nelson, we'll close the public hearing unless anybody else wishes to testify on House Bill 2833. We'll let you do a little research and see what happens, and we may need a conceptual amendment, an actual amendment, or we may need to be able to move the bill. So I think we're going to be here for most of the afternoon, so you have plenty of time.
I'll be back to you, ma'am.
Okay. Anybody else? Yeah. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2833? Let's close the public hearing. Okay. Moving to public hearing on House Bill 3073. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard House Bill 3073 on the 23rd last week, and House Bill 3073 requires that DHS, when they're investigating reports of abuse at residential training homes operated by a department or a state hospital, It requires them to address in a written report of its findings whether the person alleged to be responsible for the abuse was acting in self-defense. We were going to be considering an amendment today.
And that's the Dash 4 amendments. Anybody here to testify on the Dash 4s? Basically, my understanding of the Dash 4 amendments, they address the issue of self-defense when there is a third person involved, and I believe it came at the request of Representative Phil Barnhart to clarify that self-defense may include, in these particular situations, defense of a third party, particularly a worker there. Anybody have any questions on the amendments? You want me to call Representative Barnhart? No. Okay. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify? Close public hearing. Open a work session. Chair would move the Dash A4 amendments to House Bill 3073. Any discussion? Senator Shields.
Just a comment that as I read, self-defense means the use of physical force upon another person. That can be either kind of one of two types of force, and I'm sure that they use this. Restraint is one kind of physical force, as opposed to more offensive forms of physical force, and I think that that's what it refers to. I'm assuming that.
What's your input?
Madam Chair, Committee, my understanding from the hearing that took place on the 23rd was that the self-defense had to be consistent with the relevant training protocols and guidelines that are in place at those facilities.
Which usually means the kind of restraint. I've been through a lot of this, and I just wanted that on the record.
Okay. Senator Ringo?
Well, I just want to reference Section 2, Sub 2, Letter B, where it says, Letter A, where it says the person was acting in self-defense in response to the use or imminent use of physical force. That definition of self-defense is not specifically referenced in this amendment, the A4 amendment, but I want the record to be clear that when we're talking about self-defense, that can only take place after there has been the use of force by the person or there's the imminent threat of use of force.
Okay. So noted for the record. And I think, and how it referenced, it does that, but I think your clarification is appropriate. All right. Any further discussion? I can't remember. Did I move the A4 amendments?
You moved them.
I can't remember. All right. Chair's moved the A4 amendments. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move House Bill 3073 as amended with the Dash A4s to the Senate floor for the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Did you want to carry, Senator Shields? Okay. That'd be great. I'm just looking for those House members didn't put any senators on the bill, so they're stuck with you in the carrying. So. All right. All right. Chair would open a work session on House Bill 3151. Representative Farr, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Debbie Farr, State Representative, District 14, and House Bill 3151. It's my little baby for the session, and I think I've probably given you all more information than you need, but just real quickly, let me tell you what the bill is and what it does. It is a school lunch bill. There are four school districts in the state of Oregon that have 125 or more students, where 20% or more of those students qualify for the free and reduced program, that aren't currently using the USDA program. The way the program works, there is a specific amount that's reimbursed for free lunch, a different amount for reduced, and
and then a smaller amount for kids that can pay full price. In any case, what I have done, and I have worked very hard, the bill has been amended twice. The effective date was changed from July 05 to July 07. Another amendment was added that if a school district can demonstrate that they're providing adequate nutrition to kids through an alternative program, then they would be exempt from participating in the USDA program. All of the school districts actually that are affected by the bill do have a volunteer program that's funded either through grants or volunteer efforts and has been successful in providing lunches to kids. Powers School District, for example, has a 4.5-day school week, and they're only required to provide lunches for 4 of those days because Friday is a half day. They have an alternative program, and they would not be affected by the bill if they wanted to continue using their community support. I don't really know why they wouldn't want to still possibly be reimbursed, because the way the program works, the food doesn't have to be prepared on site, the food doesn't have to be hot, and it can be delivered on site, which is currently the way it's being done at Powers, but they could receive reimbursement from USDA for those lunches that are being served. It just would be a matter of filling out the paperwork. Alsea School District is a small district. They have a 3-day per week volunteer lunch program, and Pleasant Hill, which is closer to the Eugene area that I represent, also has a volunteer program 3 days a week. My bill requires 5 days a week, and certainly if they wanted to continue with their volunteer effort and be exempt from the USDA program, they could do that, and there are lots of creative ways that they could make that happen. I have spoken with each of the school districts. The 4th school district, Lowell, actually through community support has remodeled their kitchen and is going to be preparing meals on site because they have seen how important it is to provide nutrition for kids and what a benefit that is in the learning process. So they would actually not be affected by the bill any longer. I think that I have probably given you all the information that you need for right now and most of what you already knew, but if you have questions for me, I have a very big file folder, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
All right.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I just want to say I met with Representative Farr, and I was skeptical about state control, and she's persuaded me that this is a good thing for the school kids in our state. So I'm supporting the bill.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. I might also say that if the affected school districts would like to contract out their food service program, the Oregon Department of Education has found an adjacent school district to Powers, Alsea, and Pleasant Hill that would be willing to do that. And currently in Oregon, there are about 350 schools that receive food delivered to them from a central kitchen. So it's nothing new. And there are about 70 school districts in Oregon of 1,000 or less students that are already participate in the USDA lunch program.
Madam Chair?
No, Senator Ringo.
I'm just looking at the Dash 83 amendments. Where do those amendments come from? Are those your amendments?
Those are not my amendments, and I was hoping that maybe someone could shed light on where those amendments originated.
Yeah. But the date on them is 5/27. I mean, why did they appear at our desk today?
Oh,
well, we're short some other amendments on this bill, so.
Senator Ferriola.
I think the Dash 83 amendments or the Dash 3 amendments were as a result of the testimony by the school districts that they don't need our help, don't want our help, regard this as meddling. Members of the school boards came and discussed this issue, and right now they're providing a nutritious lunch for their students using volunteers, and since they don't accept any federal money, they're not subject to the same requirements to have an approved kitchen on site. And so what's happening is that the community is resolving this problem and has asked to be allowed to continue in that solution without the beneficiation or the benefit of our administration.
And which community are you referring to?
I think the school district members from 2 of the 4 that were mentioned. There are only 4 schools that are affected by this bill. So I think the response was to have members create an amendment that increases the population that would be affected by this bill beyond the reach of those 4 school districts. So if the bill has to pass, it makes a nice statement, but these folks really have asked to be left alone.
Okay. Further conversations?
Well, Madam Chair, that was my impression after the first hearing. After further discussions with Representative Farr, and it's consistent with what she testified today, it just seems to me that the other districts are largely accommodated in this. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but where are they now? Are they...
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the districts that would be exempted with the Dash 3 amendments would be Powers and ALSEI because they're districts that have under 300 children. Powers currently would be exempted from my bill. The way the bill is written is it just asks if a school district can demonstrate they're meeting kids' nutritional requirements for an alternative program, they don't have to participate in the federal program. And clearly Powers would be, and they could be exempt. ALSEI is providing lunches 3 days a week, so that's the rub for them. Their volunteers could certainly do some creative things in providing lunches, and they could receive reimbursement from USDA. For example, if they prepare a hot lunch and deliver it on Mondays, they could prepare a cold lunch for Tuesday, and that lunch could be refrigerated, and then it could be served to the kids that need to eat the lunch. You know, I mean, the motivation behind the bill was not to create any sort of financial hardship to the school districts, but just to be sure that kids that are relying on that meal, and there are a lot of kids that don't have adequate nutrition at home.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that the school districts asked for this.
Right. All right. Any other questions for Representative Farr? Appreciate your work. We're got a little constitution problem for the moment. We'll be in touch. So, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3151. Well, we got a long list, guys. So, for the time being. Mr. Gallagher, do you wish to testify on 2429? Come on up. I'm assuming you had a good excuse. They were already here. I'm going to open a public hearing on 2429.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer was just beating me up down in the conference committee.
I figured you had a good excuse.
Somewhat painful experience.
we'll try to make this one less painful.
Right. We're very supportive of this bill. Tom Gallagher, representing Snitzer Steel Industries. We're very supportive of this bill. It's my fault that on the House side we didn't notice that the word shredder was still in the bill, and that's not the villain from Ninja Turtles. It's the operation that Snitzer Steels performs at the end after all of the cars have gone through a wrecker or a dismantler and are cubed up and they're delivered to Snitzer Steel or sold to us. We buy them as recycled metals and then rip them apart. So we can't meet all of the tests of the bill because it's already been done by the dismantler. The plates are gone, the other things are gone, etc. So on this amendment would make the bill fit with the whole recycling process. And I hope for your support.
Madam Chair, I'm supportive.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. That was very brief testimony. I assume the proponent's okay. I was sorry I was talking to staff with the amendment.
I've talked with the representatives on the House side, and it's not a problem with concurrence.
Okay. All right.
Good work session.
Anything else for Mr. Gallagher? Let's let these other folks go. Let's open a work session. Chair is going to move the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2429. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Good thing, because we'd be in trouble. Who'd like to carry the bill? Motion carries. If you want to carry it, Senator Ringo, it's all yours. All right. Okay. All right. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3075. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3075 provides that a child who's placed by a public agency in substitute care program is considered a resident for school purposes.
Thank you. Mr. Baker, Ms. Sherbo, Mr. George.
You've just qualified for the prize of more names in one little square than I have ever seen, ever, in 14 years. But good job. At least I could read all of your handwriting.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, my name is Angela Sherbo. I'm a senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. House Bill 3075 addresses the important issue of school stability for children in foster care, a particularly vulnerable group of students in this state. I'm pleased to report to you that that bill passed the House unanimously 55-0, indicating, I think, the support of all of us adults in the state for this particular population. Mr. Baker, at my right, is a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project who specializes in education law and can answer any of your questions. And Mr. George from the Department of Human Services is here to talk to you about the particular transportation funding issue with regard to the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Baker?
Chair Brown. Chair Brown, members of the committee, House Bill 3075 aims to decrease school mobility for children in foster care. This is a very highly mobile population. The Casey Foundation has estimated that 65% of children in foster care will have seven or more school moves. 30% of that population have 10 or more school moves. The aim is to decrease that mobility, resulting in better academic achievement and graduation rates. This is a slight change to the residency statute. It will permit the juvenile court to make a best interest determination and consider all the individual factors for each child when looking at whether or not the child should remain in the prior school placement or move to the new school.
Thank you. Mr. George, welcome back. Weren't you here last night?
Chair Brown, I was.
It was foggy by then.
Mm-hmm. Thank goodness for reversible ties.
Good line. Can I have one?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, foster care program manager for the Department of Human Services. And I am here also to be in support of the House Bill 3075. We've worked for the last 2 years with Juvenile Rights Project and a pretty wide group of folks talking about a number of issues that surround foster children specifically and their educational needs. And this is yet but one or two provisions that are going to help us move towards educational success for our kids. I would draw attention to that we do have a funding issue, and we are at this point in time have asked that we will be projecting about $350,000 that we will be spending on this program per school year, and that's going to be based on utilization of our system of care flex funds that we are anticipating having approval to be able to use. This is a group of kids that...
And I want to clarify for the record, that's out of existing dollars that you have at your service, at your beck and call.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. These are flexible funds that we have through our system of care agreement. And right now we have a number of foster parents. We have a number of other folks that transport kids to school, and this will allows us to provide that funding. It will also allow us then to support those school placements with the other language change in the bill that opens up the opportunity for us to look at the best interest of a child and their school placement. So that's the direction we're heading in, and we'd ask for support.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Sherbrooke.
Senator Brown, I just wanted to further clarify what I think Mr. George was testifying, and I think the committee would be nice to have on the record, is that DHS is a public agency to which this bill applies pursuant to Section it's on page 2, line 6.
Thank you. Mr. Schober, Mr. Baker, we were here last night hearing Senate Bill 818, which has become known as the Foster Parents Bill of Rights. And following the hearing, I just wanted to hear from parents who expressed frustration with the juvenile dependency system. And in fact, the only parent that came up, her daughter had been in care for the last year, and at this point in time has been in 4 foster care homes. Mr. George was here to hear the testimony, but... our system needs change, and we need it quickly, and we really appreciate the work you all are doing to make our system better. So, any questions for this panel? I think you're off the hook.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3075?
close the public hearing. We have no amendments, correct?
No amendments.
No amendments. Chair's going to... 8:15? 8:15? No, I think it was 8:18. I'm starting to get lost in the bill numbers, but we're in work session on House Bill 3075. There are no further amendments. The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. It is my understanding that the Department of Human Services still use $350,000 of their flex care funds, which have already been appropriated or in the appropriating process for the cost of transportation of children associated with the passage of this particular bill, and these funds are to be used when the transportation costs are not covered by any other existing public funds. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing seeing none, so ordered, and I'll carry this bill. Okay. Oh, you're probably right. I had Sarah Shields and I are arguing. I had the bill number wrong. It was 8:15 last night. His charitable choice bill is 8:18, so I got too many bill numbers in my head. So you're right. I'm wrong. I admit it. Okay.
You make a note about the record, would you?
For the record, I am wrong.
I'm having fun today. What can I say?
Yeah, I think it's great. All right. Let's go up to the top of the list. Open the work session on Senate Bill 1011. Mr. Higby, anybody else wishing to testify? Mr. Gardner, come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brad Higby appearing on behalf of Vioxx Victims United in support of Senate Bill 1011. This bill has had a hearing and a couple of work sessions in the Judiciary Committee, so Senator Ringo is quite familiar with the bill.
That's right.
And I just wanted to say a few brief words in support of it, Madam Chair. 1977, the legislature adopted a product liability statute of limitation 2 years from the injury. Up until June of 2001, the courts had interpreted that to mean that a prospective plaintiff had 2 years from the injury or 2 years from the discovery of that injury or actually who was responsible for the injury on the theory that you've got to know who done it to you and what did it to you before you had a chance to bring some sort of an action. But in June of 2001, the Oregon Supreme Court in a Gladhart opinion... Mr. Substitute Chair, should I read anything into you wielding the gavel just then?
No, right. I'm just wanting to pass it down to him or somebody else.
Like at the top.
We can have a community forum here.
That'd be interesting. I didn't bring one of my own. But anyway, to continue, if I might, members of the committee here. In 2001, the Oregon Supreme Court said that, no, that's an overly broad interpretation of the statute. Plaintiffs would only have 2 years from the injury. When that was in, as I said, June of 2001, when the legislature next met, House Bill 2080 was introduced to remedy that, wherein essentially the legislature said, no, actually we did mean to provide folks with 2 years from the discovery and made it explicit in the statute.
I'm the wrong chair.
Madam Chair and musical chairs. ORS 3905, as amended by House Bill 2080, is nearly perfectly drafted, and we would be more than happy to avail ourselves of specifically ORS 3905, Section 2, Sub A, which allows for 2 years after the date on which the plaintiff discovers or reasonably should have discovered the injury or the causal relationship between the injury or damage and the product, or the causal relationship between the injury or damage and the conduct of the defendant. You'll note, Madam Chair, in Senate Bill 1011, Section 1, Sub 2, virtually the same language is there, and that's really essentially all we're trying to do here is extend the same provisions that already exist in law to these folks. And why do we have to do that? An amendment was adopted last session that makes this provision prospectively applicable only to injuries occurring after January 1 of 2004. Despite the fact this had been the standard for nigh on 24 years, I believe that the argument that Mr. Gardner had made previously in the Judiciary Committee was it would be only fair to provide some sort of a ramp-up lead time for businesses that might have to be prepared for the new standard. However, coming to the chase, Madam Chair, that is rather unfortunate for the numbers. I've been saying scores of people. I'm personally aware of just over a dozen or so that might be affected in this manner who had taken a COX-2 inhibitor drug, either Vioxx or Celebrex or Bextra, and suffered a heart attack or stroke while taking that particular drug and thought nothing more about the connection between the stroke that they might have had in 1999 when these drugs first came on the market, or in 2000 or 2001, until September 30th, 2004. That's the date that Merck pulled Vioxx from the market after one of their studies indicated that there was a substantial risk of cardiovascular event from use of their product, Vioxx. It was at that time, Madam Chair, that we contend that that date is the discovery, that folks actually learned that there might actually be a connection between the COX-2 inhibitor drug they were taking at the time that they actually had a heart attack or a stroke. Unfortunately, because of the way the statute reads, their period for filing some sort of a claim expired years, in some cases, before they actually learned who did it and what did it to them. Therefore, Madam Chair, we're narrowly trying to remedy the, as I've been calling it, gap in the statute of limitation fix from last session for these people who are real people with a real problem, not some prospective what-if, conjectural, maybe sometime down the road notion, but real people that have a problem. They are barred by the statute of limitation. If I can use the word advisedly, lucky enough to have a stroke after January 1, 2004, they wouldn't have any problems. They'd have available to them the statute that the legislature unanimously adopted last session. But they don't in the cases of those people who had actually had a heart attack or a stroke in 2000, 2001, 2002. So with that, Madam Chair, I would eagerly encourage the committee to join me in supporting Senate Bill 1011. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Gardner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Gardner appearing today for Pharma. What I'm passing out to you is the staff measure summary on the Senate side of House Bill 2080, A. Engrossed, which is the piece of legislation that was referred to by the prior witness. The Gladhart decision, in our view, and in the view of the business community and its legal counselors, was not a wrongly decided case. It was a correct construction of the law. We recognized that it had a certain degree of harshness to it because it, in effect, imposed a two-year statute of ultimate repose. That was the legal effect of the case, and that it was something that deserved to be looked at. The major issue that divided the trial bar and the business community was whether or not the change to the Gladhart doctrine should be prospective only or fully retroactive. And that was something that we had Rich Lane and I, Senator Ringo may remember, had a heated and a spirited discussion in front of the both the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee. And ultimately, with guidance from the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, now the head of the Corrections Division, the basic decision was made that the change from the Gladhart Doctrine would be prospective only, with a certain set of narrow transition rules, which I would concede do not apply, at least as far as I know, in the case of most of the plaintiffs to whom Mr. Higbee is referring. That was a conscious, deliberate decision that I think every member of the Judiciary Committees on both sides understood. That was the essence of the agreement. Trial lawyers understood the consequences of it. Business community understood the consequences of it. Both sides gave up something to get that deal. And it was fully recognized, most eloquently, I think, in Rich Lane's testimony, which I didn't bring with me, but I can certainly supply the committee, that some people are going to fall outside the change in the law that was made to the Gladhart Doctrine. Everybody knew that. Everybody understood that. It is a harsh consequence of any statute of limitations, any statute of repose, that there are going to be people outside the limits of a statute of repose. Remember that a statute of repose works whether or not there is discovery of the injury. Discovery is irrelevant to the functioning of a statute of repose. And there are people who argue that it's inappropriate to have any statute of repose in the case of a product liability cause of action. There are people who would disagree with that proposition. But the real question here is whether or not it's appropriate on a product-specific basis to deviate from the agreement, the explicit agreement reached between the plaintiff side and the defense side last session, an agreement that was ratified by the Senate Judiciary Committee without dissent. That's the policy issue before you.
Mr. Gardner, I have a couple questions. You represent pharma. The potential defendants in these cases are who? They're Merck. Who else?
Pfizer. And I'm not, there may be some others, but those are the ones I'm aware of.
Merck and Pfizer?
Yeah.
So if we're here elected to look out for our constituents and for the citizens of Oregon, are we making a choice? We want to look out for two out-of-state pharmaceutical companies as opposed to injured Oregonians. And you're asking us to say we should choose the out-of-state pharmaceutical companies over the injured Oregonians.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I guess what I'm asking you to do is to consider whether or not you should stick with the policy choice that the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously endorsed last session.
Well, Mr. Gardner, I wasn't part of the backroom deal. I understand that the discussions were made. Certainly, I voted out of committee. I voted off the Senate floor. I think it's hard to tell injured Oregonians that they should be left out because some deal may have been made between a lobbyist for the pharmaceuticals and a lobbyist for the trial lawyers, and because of some deal that two lobbyists made, they don't get their day in court.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that as I mentioned earlier in my testimony, each and every statute of repose has an inevitably harsh effect on occasion on people who are on the wrong side of the statute of repose. And the policy decision rests in your hands as to whether or not those are good ideas. But there's nothing particularly unusual about the impact of a statute of repose on a product case.
No, I mean, just pushing back a little bit, I think you can say the Gladhart decision complied with Oregon law, but it certainly surprised many lawyers on the plaintiffs and defense side of the bar, and it certainly was at odds with the rules of other states.
I would, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would not disagree with the proposition that it surprised people on both sides.
But also it was different from what other states have. Other states would have the discovery rule in products cases. Isn't that fair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, some do. They're really all over the map in terms of whether you superimpose a statute of repose on top of a discovery rule.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Shields, any questions?
No, I'm just gathering information. I certainly have heard a lot from constituents and had telephone calls and messages from victims, quote-unquote, and so I'm very concerned about this.
Thank you. Mr. Higbee, do you have something to follow up with?
Yes, Mr. Floating Chair, if I may, members of the committee, just a couple of points. Mr. Gardner did make continual reference to the statute of ultimate repose, and just to be clear, the 10-year statute of repose in statute is not a problem. We have no difficulty with that. We're not seeking to have any special treatment from the statute of repose. In those circumstances, 10 years after first purchase for consumption, while harsh, is something that we could actually live with. Rather, we're taking exception with the statute of limitation and try to essentially, as I said, restore the former standard that applied for nigh on 24 years to this subset of people. Secondly, Madam Chair, now...
Sorry.
It's okay.
He called me floating chair.
He referred to us as floating chair.
Keep this up. I'm going to need some Dramamine and talk with some of my friends from the industry behind me to get it. But might also say that in terms of the Judiciary Committee testimony, whether or not there were deals made previously or not, I don't know. I was not party to that. I do not represent the trial lawyers. None of these people who are interested in this particular bill are trial lawyers who are injured. They are actually folks looking to try to get their day in court. They're not looking for any of you to agree that this is a nasty product and these are horrible companies, rather. They're just looking to get the 2 years from discovery provision that everybody else gets to enjoy if they're injured before the case or after the effective date of House Bill 28 from last session, or the other 44, 45, 46 states that don't have the specific limitation that applies to these folks here. And then finally, I'll conclude there.
Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, we're in work session?
Yes.
And there are no amendments, are there?
No amendments that I have.
No. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1011 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 1011 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Ringo, did you want to carry this?
Sure.
Senator Ringo will carry. All right. We got Kelly Smith Sky here. Okay. Let's go back on the record. On House Bill 2833, Mr. Nelson, Senator Ringo's sharp eyes caught it. We've talked with Ledge Counsel. Mr. Nelson's spoken with his client. Why don't you respond to Senator Ringo's concern on the record, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, you're absolutely correct about your observation. I did check with counsel. I also checked with the client. You have two choices. The client is basically adopting their budget prior to June 30th for the next year, so it won't have any practical effect, and we can move forward. The other, if we were to fix it, we just put emergency clause on it.
Okay.
But you're right.
Doesn't matter to me.
We'd prefer to go ahead, but whatever you choose.
I think it's fine. I can't imagine that it'll be a problem.
Fine with me.
All right. I'm also wanting to keep bills moving through the system and not stress legislative counsel any further than we've already stressed them. I think their hair is on fire right now. All right. We're in work session. The chair would move House Bill 2833 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. We're going to let Senator Westland carry that bill because he doesn't have enough going on in his life. All right. Minutes, I assume, not at 5. All right. Is Ms. Guy in the room? Okay. Let's go to the front page again. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1068. I know there are possibly multiple competing amendments. Who would like to come forward? 1068, Ms. Miller, Ms. Sky, why don't you come on forward? And you're the DDA in Marion County? Okay. All right, Ms. Miller, since you're the one with the bad news, I'm sure today, why don't you tell us what you have to say?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations with the Oregon Judicial Department. After our testimony last week on this bill, we talked about ways to mitigate the fiscal impact since you declared me the winner with the bad news last week. We did go out into the hall and talk about this. It's my understanding that the District Attorney's Association will be offering amendments today to remove the felony provision to the bill that does ameliorate the fiscal impact that we prepared. There's one important thing to put on the record, however, on the new crime that remains. We have been in negotiations with the District Attorney's Association. Our minimal fiscal on that piece is predicated on the representations that were made by the district attorneys that for the most part, that will not be filed as a separate charge. If it is filed as a separate charge, it will have a large fiscal. So we are working with the District Attorneys Association, asking them to please inform their members of the representations that were made to this committee, and we shall see if that plays out in real life. If it does not, the Judicial Department will find itself in the position of coming back to talk to the Emergency Board if, in fact, a large number of new charges are filed. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Who wants to go next? Ms. Sky.
I'd be happy to. Kelly Sky, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And as I testified before, I think it's important for the committee to resist the temptation to create a new crime every time we have identified a problem in the criminal justice system. The main problem that was identified by the District Attorney's Office and the victims' advocates when we were here last was that police, when they determine that someone is on a release agreement, that they're violating the condition of a release agreement, that they have no contact with the victim, that they're not sure whether or not they can arrest that person because the statute giving them authority to arrest on violation of a release agreement limits it to certain offenses. So a person would have to be on a release agreement for certain domestic violence offenses. And this is provided in ORS 133.310(6). I am seeking amendments that will simply clarify that and take out the portion of that statute that confines the arrest authority to those certain domestic violence offenses and allows the officer to arrest for any violation of a no-contact provision on whatever offense the person is on a release agreement for, whether it be domestic violence or not. That makes it very clear to police if they come across somebody who's having contact with a victim of any offense, they would have authority to arrest. That clarifies that problem. It allows us not to create a new crime, not to risk the fiscal impact. I've spoken with the Public Defense Services Commission. They did not have a request for a fiscal impact. I will be encouraging them to submit one. This is a new crime that we're creating. It will have a fiscal impact not only for the Judicial Department but for Public Defense Services Commission. And although the District Attorney's Office presents that it will be just simply an extra charge added onto existing charging instruments, these are two prosecutors you've had before you here today, and they don't have authority over every prosecutor in this state. I believe, and the people that I've spoken to from my organization and judges believe, that this will be issued as a subsequent offense, because frequently the contact isn't learned about until you get to trial on the underlying offense, and that is when they learn about it and will issue the new crime, which will require appointing an indigent defense attorney and a subsequent hearing, which gives you the fiscal. So what I am offering is a simple way to expand police officers' authority to arrest in these circumstances. If they find that someone's violating this no-contact agreement, they can arrest them at that time. They can the release agreement is revoked, their bail is revoked, they forfeit their bail, and they can be prosecuted for contempt of court. As I mentioned earlier, any type, as I mentioned in my previous testimony, any contact with a victim that is threatening or coercive in nature can be prosecuted under contempt, under tampering with the witness, sometimes under hindering. There are different provisions for which this can be prosecuted if it rises to that level. But the crime that is before you today does not simply deal with coercive contact. It deals with any contact, and that contact can be taken care of by the simple amendment to the authority of the officer to arrest without having any fiscal impacts. My amendment is not here, but I'm asking that the committee consider that as an option to creating a new crime.
All right. Ms. Madam Deputy DA from Marion County, whose name I can't remember.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Jean Kunkel from Marion County. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And if I could just respond a little bit to both Ms. Wilson and Ms. Skye. I have received a message from Mr. Berry indicating that he is willing to commit to training at the summer conference for the district attorneys, which is held in August, that these cases, whenever possible, should be filed on the same document. And so that would be spread throughout the association. Ms. Skye referred to creating a new crime for every problem that we have in the criminal justice system. I would view this as these are cases where defendants are consistently disregarding the court's order regarding conditions that they have placed on their release. In order to be released under the Oregon Criminal Code, particularly in domestic violence cases, there are certain criteria. And so these people have the criteria on a piece of paper, and they are basically, you know, disregarding it with no intent to follow through because they want to have contact with the victim. And, and the ODAA's position is that that deserves to be a criminal act as opposed to a civil act. The police officer confusion regarding mandatory arrest is only part of our position. And the other part is that we really think that that ought to be, it's appropriate to label that as a criminal act when they're it's such disregard of the court's order. I think that if you also look at this proposed statute systemically, it's been my experience that this contact is usually discovered prior to the trial date. And that, in fact, I think that it has the potential of having a positive impact on the fiscal part of it, because my experience has been that when a person is then charged with this second crime, when we have proof that they've been having contact, and when that will actually be part of the evidence at trial, that a lot of times these cases resolve short of trial, which saves quite a lot of money in court staff, court time, court-appointed attorney's time.
So I guess my question is either for both of you, Ms. Kunkel, Ms. Skye, and that is, under Ms. Skye's version, which I appreciate you guys don't have in writing in front of you because we don't either, what happens, and actually under your version as well, Ms. Kunkel, what happens if the crime is already prosecuted and we learn of the, the contact that was during the pendency of the first proceedings? That's the word.
Madam Chair and Senators, I can only speak from the Marion County perspective. Mm-hmm. If that were to occur in Marion County, the likelihood is that contempt would not be charged.
Okay.
It has happened. The only exception that I would see to that is if we thought that a victim was in great danger and for some reason that prior criminal charge had not resolved in any way to place the defendant on some kind of supervision or get them some kind of treatment, and we felt that that was really, really important. I could imagine that we might file that after the fact, but I think that those cases would be very, very rare.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't think we've ever done it.
Ms. Guy, you want to respond? I guess, you know, what happens if the contact during the pendency of the original proceedings isn't discovered until after the conviction on the original proceedings?
Right. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my perspective is coming from Multnomah County, where and the majority of these domestic violence cases are misdemeanors. The prosecutors in the misdemeanor unit don't talk to the victims frequently until the day of trial, and that's where I am. Okay. That's why I am presenting to you that they don't learn of this contact until the day of trial.
Right.
And that is why I say that when the contact that I'm talking about is frequently voluntary on the part of the victim, and so frequently that contact is discovered when the victim and the defendant walk in the front door of the courtroom day of trial, and the victim is recanting for whatever reason. And it's at that point that if the prosecutor realizes that their case is not as strong as it may have been otherwise, or they lose at trial, that is when the subsequent charge would arise.
All right. Any questions for the panel? I guess I'm wrestling with this. My concern is just timing, and either version we risk going to Senate budget, which may make it extremely difficult to get through the process. What are my other issues? Okay. Senator Ringo, this is really...
I'm sorry I missed your testimony. Kelly, I think you were going to bring a sample of a release agreement, and I also thought that the district attorney from Washington County, Gina Skinner, or somebody from Multnomah County was going to. Did you bring one?
I brought Chair Brown.
You can approach the bench.
I have...
she wishes she were a judge.
There are a lot of things I wish right now, Senator Ringo, but being a judge is not one of them.
I would ask members from around the...
And these are some of them that came about, and this is to follow up my point at our prior hearing, which was that the no contact provision is often in small print in these release agreements. Defendants are either released from the jail due to overcrowding or bailed out. They're not notified that they're subject to a crime for violation of this release agreement. And that the fine print on these release agreements is not going to be adequate to notify them of that, and that victims do not get notice that this is a condition. So that when the victim shows up at the defendant's door having the voluntary contact, the victim has not been notified that that's a problem.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Well, Kelly, I just want to clarify, because this is fine print, exactly where the no contact agreement is. I think it's under the second from last page, special conditions. It says, I will not have contact in any manner with the following.
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I provided you with a number of agreements, so I don't know which one you're talking about.
I see.
I have Baker County, Josephine County.
So all of these are one-page agreements then?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
So you, Ms. Skye, what you're, for all intents and purposes, arguing is that what we should do, as opposed to create a separate crime, is allow for mandatory arrest for violation.
Correct. And Chair Brown, members of the committee, the current statute doesn't actually provide mandatory arrest, but it says it's presently released as a... Oh, it does. Mandatory arrest for violation of the no-contact provision. The current statute has a clause in there that says that also constitutes domestic violence as defined in 135230, and it's that, and is released to a charge that is under 135230 to 135290.
Doesn't say violation of a release order.
No, it does.
Okay.
It says that the police officer shall arrest and take into custody a person without a warrant if the person has probable cause to believe that they're on a release, failed to comply with the no contact condition of a release agreement, but it has to be a release agreement that is a domestic violence offense as defined in there. And so my amendments will just take out that portion of the clause so that if a police officer comes across anybody who they know is in violation of a no contact provision, it could be a bar fight and they have a no contact order with the victim. If they find those two people together, they can arrest them. There will be no, the officer will not be required to go back and look and see if it's a domestic violence contact, authority to arrest. They can just go ahead and arrest.
Ms. Kunkel, any thoughts?
Chair Brown and Senators, I did have your assistant make a copy of the Marion County release agreement, which you can see the no contact is in two places on there, in bold, about in the middle of the page, and then there's also a section where it can be written in at the bottom. The only response that I would have to that, Your Honor, I mean,
let's all do it.
I'm sorry.
It's going to her head.
I forgot where I was.
Yeah.
The response that I would have to Ms. Skye is that, just what I've said before, is that we think that these intentional violations and these kind of domestic violence situations where, you know, I can't prove it, but I know that in the majority of these cases, the victims are being subjected to pressure to change their stories. I mean, every single time they have contact, they recant, almost without exception, is that that kind of behavior should really be reflected as a criminal charge. But,
I'm sure.
The thing that makes it so hard is that you're both right.
Yeah.
You know, as I look at these, I almost think this needs to be so clear to these people, this no contact order. And just really, really bold letter. I mean,
and the Marion County one, frankly, Senator Ringo, comes closest to anything. I mean, some of these, like, are in very small print. You guys get the gold star for release agreement. So, yeah. Senator Ringo, I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, that's okay. That's okay. It's just that it seems to me that you both raised legitimate points. I would like to see that this no contact provision could be made very explicit, tattoo it on their forehead or something so that they know, rather than bearing it in the fine print of an agreement.
And I guess I just want to emphasize Ms. Kunkel's point, and I hear Ms. Skye what you're saying, but this is a particular problem in domestic violence cases. We don't normally see this problem in bar fights. I mean, it probably happens once in a while in bar fights, but generally speaking, this is an issue pertaining to the incidents of domestic violence. Okay. So with that, I want to let you two sit back, unless Ms. Skye, you want to respond?
Oh. Respectfully, Chair Brown, members of the committee, the new crime that's being created here is not limited to domestic violence crimes, which is
we're really wrestling here because, as Senator Ringo is, you both raise really good points. My concern is we may get nothing if we don't make a decision here very quickly. I'm going to bring Ms. Hebb up. Did you have a question with this panel? Sorry, Senator Shields.
No, I just wanted to say, Your Honor, that I wanted to thank them for helping you live out one of your adamant points.
Yes. Ms. Hubb, your thoughts, and I guess, and the reason I'm asking you is from your perspective as from the domestic violence community, and my very real concern that even if we do one or the other of these things, this bill is going to, you know, it's got an uphill battle. So
I appreciate that, Chair Brown and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, for the record. And I guess from my perspective, having worked with victims of domestic violence from the civil perspective, what I see is, I think, as Ms. Kunkel pointed out, an intentional attempt to recontact and to basically further intimidate victims and try to keep them from participating in the prosecution, which is pending. And I guess I'd just like to make a couple of points. And one is that, while I agree that it's absolutely incumbent upon us to make sure that our paperwork is clear, and I haven't had the opportunity to view all of the records that Ms. Skye provided, but I do agree that it's important to have those records be clear. On the other hand, I think we have a person who has been arrested after having committed a violent crime, allegedly, has been in jail and has been released for that and has been given paperwork saying these are the conditions of your release. And I think that puts a person on pretty good notice that they need to be careful to understand what the terms of release are. And if there are particularly confusing release agreements, then I think that needs to be resolved. I think that's sort of a different issue than what we're talking about today, which is if you are subject to conditions of the court, then you need to be complying with them, and there should be sanctions for failing to comply with them. The only other couple of points I want to point out for the committee is that at the time of a victim's separation or attempt to separate from a batterer, it is also the time of greatest violence and the greatest lethality of violence, studies have shown from Johns Hopkins University conducted by Jacqueline Campbell, who's a doctor there. And so I think it's a period of time in which we need to be very careful. And I also think that although I might agree with Ms. Skye's suggestion, and in fact I'd be supportive of making both changes to the law, but if we simply make the mandatory arrest change...
Instead of like cutting the baby in half, we're going to like to have twin here. So.
But,
no.
But I do think that that Ms. Skye's suggestion would not really resolve the problem, because what happens is if you have someone arrested, as we know, unfortunately, the jails are underfunded and people get released, and there's just the sort of furthering of that cycle again. And so I think the point of making it a crime is that you have higher sanctions, you have a greater sense of accountability in the charges that are brought against you. So I'd be supportive overall of the ODAA proposal for those reasons.
Okay.
Thanks.
Questions for this wonderful panel? When Sarah leaves, could you ever bring it and scream at Senator Rango?
Go get Rango. Drag him in here.
Please. So, where's the committee?
Further in the hallway, Madam Chair.
I understand that. We're in work session.
Wherever you want, Your Honor.
Okay, well. Thank you, Sarah. We have now three options available to us. We have the -1 amendments, which are from ODAA. We have, or can have, probably in the next 12 to 36 hours, the OC delay amendments. Or we have from Ms. Hebb, we could combine both the -1 and the -2 amendments, which will make probably both sides hate the bill, but it might make it get through the process. Senator Rango, any strong feelings?
Well, I wanted to know the fate of this in Budget Committee. And do all those amendments have the same fiscal?
Ms. Miller, come on back up.
Sorry about that. But
that's my concern as well. No fiscal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Nancy Miller, if you adopt the -1s, it alleviates our fiscal as long as we can rely, again, on the representations of the DAs that it won't be charged, for the most part, as a separate charge.
I'm going to remember this approach in
future, do, Madam Chair.
In future proposals. Senator Farrioli.
Part of the problem is that district attorneys, being the highest elected law enforcement officials within their communities, which gets you in a big argument with the sheriff right now. you can educate them. You can even offer CLE credits. You cannot bind them. And so the question that occurs to me is that certain district attorneys will be compelled, or feel they are compelled, by concerns of safety for victims, to prosecute these as separate crimes when they feel it's necessary. So there's no guarantee that you don't have circumstances where they won't be indicted separately.
And Madam Chair, Senator Farrioli, we believe that there will be some that will be charged as separate crimes regardless of whether they all do it the same way, just because of circumstances that you're talking about. Whether that number would get it over the 50,000 is unlikely, so you probably wouldn't have a fiscal issue there. It's the bulk of the practice, I would say, that's the concern. And if folks can get on board with what the association is saying, and for the bulk of the practice, charge them as part of the underlying crime, we're not going to see a fiscal that's going to send it over 50K.
So, Ms. Miller, if we were to say to the courts, you need to have the release agreement, say, in 30-point type or whatever it is, no contact with the victim, will that be fiscal?
Madam Chair, thank you. I was just turning around to Ms. Seidlick because she's the forms expert.
Ooh.
Yes, no.
Madam Chair, not much, says the expert.
Do we need a bill to do that?
No.
Ah. Okay. Any other thoughts?
I was about to say something. I thought better of it.
That happens often, Senator.
Not enough around here, I'm afraid.
I don't know. Okay. So Senator Ringo.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to say, this is a tough one. I have the dash one amendments here. I don't see in my file the dash twos.
That's because they are still in legislative council.
That's a good reason I don't have them. And I know that the time is running out quickly on the session, but I would want to see what the dash twos look like, compare them with the dash ones, and I'm just asking whether we can make a decision tomorrow.
Okay, I'm willing to do that. I'm also interested in a form disclosure piece, and I think maybe I would like to avoid telling the form person to do that, but that's something we talk about. I'm also interested in, I hear your argument in not making a separate crime, but I think you raised some points about the arrest statutes. And sometimes when you try and add or change the direction of the train, you end up going in the direction of a train that you're not very excited about. But this may be one of those times. So let's set this over till tomorrow. But we're going to move it tomorrow. And it sounds like we're good on the fiscal. I'm sure we can get help to move this through the House, assuming we can get it out of here. Ms. Sky, I think instead of prohibiting the creation of a second crime, we'd like to see your concerns addressed about the probable cause arrest piece. And we can talk about that after committee. Anything else?
One minute, Chair.
Senator Ringo?
I would just like to talk to Ms. Kunkel about the what dash one amendments, not right now on the record.
Great.
I wasn't here when
I haven't even seen it.
Okay.
Well, I'll show them
all right.
To you.
So let's set this over till tomorrow, have people read the amendments, see if we can get some of Ms. Guy's concerns addressed, and go from there. Okay? Thank you. You can go now. I just wanted your thoughts. All right.
See, I'm finished with my conversation.
Okay. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1068.
I don't know if I could take 7 lawyers much longer.
I forgot Ms. Hebb was a lawyer.
Shame on you.
All right. all right. We'd like to have Senator Verger come down for House Bill 2537. We did 2800. Let's go to House Bill 3044. Ms. Harris.
Madam Chair, committee, House Bill 3044 directs elections officials to allow an individual with a disability to proceed to the head of the line of electors while waiting to vote or deposit a ballot.
All right. Anybody wishing to testify in House Bill 3044? Yeah, let's call the sponsor's office.
I have a quick question.
And yes, Senator Shields.
Well, I haven't thought about this much, but you get to, your favorite Fred Meyer's Safeway, whatever, and there's always a disabled and a handicap.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see some athlete hopping out of the car. That's because they happen to have an elderly aunt or uncle or whatever has the same thing, and so they use the parking pass. Do we have ways of clearly defining who has the disability in this bill?
I think it's pretty well defined as a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, has a record of such an impairment, or is recorded as having such an amendment. Senator Farrioli.
I'm sure it's clear to me that this bill was written for a state that has a polling place.
That's probably clear.
Yeah.
So could we get a definition of a line?
Sure, if we can find the sponsors of the bill.
Well, I just thought I'd ask my questions because we're waiting for the sponsor anyway.
The point is that
I think the most relevant provision, and folks maybe just need, maybe we can, by consensus, delete lines 13 and 14, but the key language is voting, deposit at a voted ballot at a site designated under ORS 254. So... we need Senator Ringo. Yeah.
Would you come in to vote for one of mine?
Well, I'd like to visit each committee each day for some period of time to be of service.
We have in front of us House Bill 3044. Anybody answering in the House? Ms. Harris? Anybody answering in the House? Okay, all right. The issue for us is because the bill still refers to voting at a polling place. The chair has the dash one amendments, which were contained in another bill that we've already moved to this chamber, that I would like to move on to House Bill 3044, but I'm certainly willing to entertain conceptual amendments, i.e. deleting the voting at a polling place. But I don't know whether that bill, all references regarding polling place elections, ever passed the House. So we're not going to know the answer to that. Okay, we're going to close public hearing work session on 3044 and open a work session on House Bill 2537. Okay.
You wanted me here for that?
Yes, I do want you here for that, Senator Rango.
I'm only kidding.
Okay. I need you for everything. Senator Verger, why don't you come forward? We have committee members in front of you, the dash two amendments to House Bill 2537. Senator Verger, you want to tell us about the first portion of the amendments? I think they are extremely similar to Senate Bill 152, which this chamber passed a couple weeks ago.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joanne Verger, State Senator from District 5. Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that Senate Bill 152 refers to the bill of the North Bend Airport. I became very concerned over the weekend when the media carried a story saying that the bill was absolutely dead over in the House. I have no desire whatsoever to make any comments. We all have our issues, and I'm very sympathetic to that in this political process. What is concerning me is that it is such a strongly supported bill, and that it also is supported both in the House and in the Senate because it is an economic engine for the state of Oregon. And so the dash two amendments, I believe, would have some assurance, perhaps, of that not being lost in the process, while other issues would be resolved in some other way.
Right. Any questions for Senator Verger?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rango.
Just a comment. I think there are political dynamics in the South Coast that make my annexation battles look easy.
Well, we have our challenges, but that's all right.
Yes,
that's
right.
The one wonderful thing about challenges is it's a good democracy, and we all get right in there.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions for Senator Verger? We really appreciate you bringing this to our attention and appreciate your leadership on this issue.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
The other proposal that the dash two amendments contain, or Senate Bill 680, which was heard in your committee, as
it
I recall.
Was. It's called Through the Fence Operations. It is allowing businesses that can be on airport property but not necessarily owned by the airport, in other words, but businesses that do business. That's the reason they call it Through the Fence Operations. We had extensive testimony. Also, there were many changes. The bill was worked on quite a bit. And finally, we got to the point that the committee was comfortable with it and passed it out.
Great. Any other questions on the through the fence portion? All right. Thank you very much, Senator Verger.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, we're in work session on House Bill 2537. Anybody else wishing to testify on the Dash 2 amendments? The chair would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2537. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move House Bill 2537 as amended to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We're going to let Senator Verger carry this bill. All right. Back to House Bill 3044. This is the bill folks were concerned about, the polling place election. Have we heard from any House members? Okay. We're getting a signal. We'll be at ease. In fact, why don't we just take a 20-minute break right now?
Excellent. Wonderful.
We will be back at 3:45. We are in recess.
Good decision,
Matt.
Thank
you.
That's like,
I tried to make them
out of play for a while.
Okay.
Are the microphones?
We're back on the record. It's still June 28th. The days are getting longer and longer and longer. I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of possible reconsideration of Senate Bill 1000. I move that we suspend the rules for the possible reconsideration of Senate Bill 1000. Discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although I believe that this is procedurally possible, it's just never been done in this way. And I would like the chair or the president to discuss the procedure by which we find an extra member of our committee in our chamber this afternoon.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Farioli, I was the minority leader for the past three sessions, actually the Democratic leader for last session, and I do not believe that I denied one suspension of the rules in the committee processes for anything. So it has not been an issue for the last 6 years because I never denied a suspension of the rules. Mr. President, do you wish to add anything?
We've checked with the Secretary of State. I believe the actions of the President being here, vote to reconsider, is appropriate, proper, and within the rules and guidelines. In addition, we're attempting to bring a bill back to make it more reflective and more inclusive in a bill that we feel that they discovered some things they want to make better. So rather than put the Senate floor through some kind of exercise of returning it or debating the bill of that nature, this is a more expedited process to allow that to happen so that we can move the bill to the floor in a more expedited fashion. So I don't think it's improper what we're doing. It's obviously not illegal. And as I say, it's well within our rules, and
follow-up question, Madam Chair?
Senator Farioli.
In your 6 years as the minority leader and the caucus leader, and, Mr. President, in your years as a member of the Senate, do you have a... Can you name a precedent for this type of activity that takes a bill literally off the president's desk and returns it to committee?
Senator Farioli, with all due respect, I do believe Bill sat on Senator Gene Durfler's desk for any number of days, weeks, and in fact months. That it is not unusual for a bill to sit on a Senate president's desk for a long period of time.
I'm sure I think we have the opposite here. I think we have a bill that barely brushed the president's desk and then went back to committee. It was my impression that that bill should come to the floor and be heard.
Well, Senator Farioli, it probably wasn't an issue in the 2001 and the 99 sessions while I was minority leader, because if the majority requested that a bill come back to committee to be more responsive to the minority, I would not have chosen to not suspend the rules. I would have suspended the rules and let it happen as a matter of course.
Madam Chair, I just wish to note for the record that this is a precedent-setting activity. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Axel?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Perioli?
No.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Motion passes. I move that we reconsider the vote by which the committee sent Senate Bill 1000 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Will this reconsideration in any way affect the minority report?
My understanding is that you still wish to do a minority report. Now that the fiscal and the language of the minority report were done, I believe it will enable us to move the minority report to the Senate floor in a much speedier manner.
Madam Chair, I submit to you that motion on this bill will offer the opportunity for us to file a minority report. It does not necessarily mean that we will file the same minority report.
That is correct. The chair intends to bring back the committee, not today, but in the next 48 hours, to have further discussion on some of the language of the bill and to address some of the concerns that have been raised. That will not happen at this point in time. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, doesn't this motion simply require a simple majority?
This particular motion does. We don't move to reconsider. No. This supermajority motion.
And, Madam Chair, just for the record, the Senate President and the Majority Leader have requested consideration from the Minority Leader regarding rule suspension permit us to move expeditiously toward the end of the legislative session. We have communicated back to the President and to the Majority Leader that request is under consideration by the caucus, and we have not yet reached our decision, hence our unwillingness today to take any action before our caucus has made a decision in that regard. And that is what puts us in the position of not being willing to take action on the request for a rule suspension in this particular instance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? The motion before the committee is to reconsider the vote by which the committee sent Senate Bill 1000 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you please call the roll, Mr. Golding?
Senator Axel?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Perioli?
No.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Motion passes. The bill is now back in front of the committee. Thank you very much. Mr. President, we appreciate your courtesies in joining us this afternoon. Let's go to House Bill 3262.
Madam Chair, are we still in work session on Senate 1000?
No, we're not. Just close the work session. House Bill 3262. All right.
not again, man.
Okay. All right. Before we go into work session on House Bill 3262, we need to reconsider House Bill 2429 because LC, we just passed it out earlier, and House Bill 2427 because LC found conflicts. Do I need to get the Senate President since the reconsideration motion and a rule suspension, Senator Farioli?
On House Bill 2426, Madam Chair.
2429 and 2427.
Madam Chair, in order to be consistent with the request of my caucus, I would not be willing to.
All right. Would you please go get the Senate President? Okay.
And Madam Chair, for the record, let me also say that we had no problem with the rule suspension on the previous consideration of Senate Bill 1000. But since we made this issue a point of request to the caucus, I would respect their wishes in the issue, and they have not rendered a decision.
I believe we did a motion reconsideration on House Bill 2050 earlier today while you were out of the room.
There you have it, Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson gave us the courtesies. Did you want us to reconsider the vote?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. While we're waiting for the Senate President, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3262. Senator Westland, I'd like you to come forward. Please be advised that the Senate President is going to be joining us shortly, and we may take a break.
He should be coming through the door any second.
Yes.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ben Westland, Senate District 27, I will hold my remarks.
Thank you very much. We close the public hearing on House Bill
3262.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to need you for these two motions, Senator, Mr. President. I'm opening a work session on House Bills 2429 and 2247 for the purpose of possible reconsideration. I move that we suspend the rules for the possible reconsideration of House Bill 2429 and 2247 because LC found conflict amendments, found conflicts with other bills that we have passed. Discussion. Any objection?
Madam Chairman?
Senator Farioli.
The motion is to suspend rules. Mm-hmm. I think we've had the discussion about rule suspension, so I would request that you do a roll call vote.
I will do that. James, please do a roll call vote.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Mr. President.
The President did not vote. The gavel.
Oh, sorry.
Gavel's fallen.
They're your members' bills.
Madam Chairman, perhaps you should reconsider that motion one more time.
I think I need a break, you guys. Excuse me for a minute. House Bills 2247 and 2429 for the purpose of possible reconsideration. I move that we suspend the rules for the possible reconsideration of House Bills 2247 and 2429. Discussion. Would you please call the roll, James?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator
Peter? Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriero?
No.
President Gordon?
Yes.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. I move that we reconsider the vote by which the committee sent House Bill 2247 and 2429 to the floor with due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Yes.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. The bills are now back in committee. Thank you very much, Mr. President. All right. Do we have the numbers?
Do we have the conflict amendments?
Yes.
No, they will be ready tomorrow.
All right. Conflict amendments will be ready tomorrow. Senator Westland, let's go back to 3262. Appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland proposing the dash two amendments to House Bill 3262. Last session, the legislature passed similar legislation for small communities that these amendments address. They actually add to that list, but they did not include safety service districts in that legislation. The service districts face many of the same challenges as the smaller cities and counties that were included in the previous legislation. Their population and tax bases are actually larger than those included in these amendments. They deal with both Black Butte and Sun River service districts and the need to provide additional services to their residents, primarily fire and police officers. Because of their small tax bases, these communities cannot compete in the wage and benefit area with Redmond, Bend, and Deschutes County itself. And because they cannot compete in wage and benefits, they sometimes have difficulty recruiting staff. The inclusion of these amendments into existing legislation will provide them an opportunity to better serve their community residents and their taxpayers. I would be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Westland? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate your input. Committee members, we have a number of folks wishing to testify on this bill, and a number of them have amendments. This is turning out to be a fairly large choo-choo train with a number of cabooses. We will hear the proponents today and then look at moving the bill tomorrow. I want an opportunity for everyone to actually read and understand the amendment. So thank you very much, Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'm not going to say your name right. Ms. Poker, you want to come on up? Parker. I'm a phonetic speller, what can I say?
Ms. Parker does not have a name.
She's the only one to testify, Madam Chair, that does not have a name.
Well, that's why we like her the best.
Actually, I think it started in my ballpark.
So. Okay.
First, I'd like to thank the Senator Brown and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. It's been my privilege to serve our country in the Air Force during the Vietnam War, and since then I've spent 28 years in public service to the state of Oregon. In 1997, Senate Bill 711 became the law, or part of the law that you have before you. The purpose of that law is to give veterans the ability to buy back at full cost up to 4 years of their military time when they decided to retire. When PERS figures retirement benefits, they're done under several methods, the full formula plus annuity and money match. Under the current rules, the retiree is given the highest monthly benefit. Unfortunately, in some cases, the highest monthly benefit also has the highest dollar amount when buying back time. The change to the ORS that I'm requesting would allow the veterans to buy back, would allow them to retire under any method they'd like, and then they could choose a lower monthly benefit in order to get a lower buyback cost. I believe when the legislators initially passed this law, they were trying to give veterans a useful benefit to acknowledge their time in service. Unfortunately, in many cases, the benefit can't be used because of the high buyback cost. This change would help alleviate the problem. The time buyback would be more affordable. Veterans could use the benefit, and they would have a choice of when to retire. On a personal note, in 2003, I realized my buyback would be too expensive to afford. At that time, it was too late to do anything, so I've waited 2 years to come to you to ask for this change. I'm hoping to keep other veterans from the same disappointments I've had and my family's had having to wait for my retirement that I thought I could do back in 2003. The Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee in the House of Representatives unanimously voted for the bill, placed it on their consent calendar, and it passed the House with no dissenting votes. I believe they saw the benefits of the bill for veterans. At this time, there's an outstanding amendment that was introduced for an emergency clause. That amendment was sent to Senator Ferrioli's office. I planned on withdrawing that amendment because I wanted the bill to go through, but since there's so many amendments to the bill, I leave that up to you to take that amendment, and if it serves the purpose of moving the bill along in a useful way, then I would appreciate that being added in. And that's really all I have to say. Thank you for your consideration. I'm asking for your support, not only for myself, but for all veterans.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your service to our country and to our state. Questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, when it comes to PERS, people talk in code, and I'm not up on the code. Could you tell me how it works to buy back?
I can give you what I understand, but I'm sure Steve Delaney knows it much better than I do.
Okay.
Mr. Delaney, why don't you come on up?
And he's been on board with this from the beginning.
Yeah. Madam Chair, while Mr. Delaney sets up to elucidate on the buyback provisions, if I may ask Ms. Broker, what is the amendment number? And I'm certain that my staff who is listening to the hearing will be working diligently to make sure that the amendment comes to the committee.
I don't know the amendment number, Senator Farioli, but I gave Sean Cleave was aware of the amendments. He talked with Representative Krupp's office on this, and I spoke with him yesterday, and he did have the information in the amendment.
The dash two amendments have the emergency costs in it. They also have an interesting provision by Senator Weschwein.
And Madam Chair, I think there is a dash one amendment also that's been distributed. So
right.
We have the amendment.
All right. Mr. Delaney, response to Senator Ringo's question, please.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of PERS. Senator Ringo, the military full-cost purchase simply states that a retiree can use those 4 years to, in essence, advance the ability to retire sooner than they would have otherwise. The benefit they get then is being produced sooner than was anticipated, and the beneficiary, the military veteran, has to pay that difference. So if we have sufficient funds on hand, for instance, to provide a $1,000 benefit, but the calculation provides a $1,200 benefit, they have to pay the $200 difference, and that's the full cost to the system. There's no cost to the employer. What is being addressed in this bill is that when PERS calculates a benefit, statute directs us to calculate it in a number of different manners, a formula, an annuity based on the benefit, and pay the member the highest amount. Well, the veterans having to pay for that. So current statute says you have to take the highest benefit. You have to give us $10,000 to retire. What if the member would rather take a lesser benefit and pay us $1,000 to be able to retire? Again, no cost to the employer. It's just how much does the veteran require to pay up front in order to retire?
Just follow up. So help me understand the class of people that this can apply to. Is it those that are receiving a military retirement because they served 20 years? She's shaking her head now, so I'll stop.
Senator, it applies to individuals that had service time prior to their coming to PERS.
Okay. Regardless of how much.
Right.
Okay.
Other questions?
Pardon me, Senator. Actually, it does have a limit of up to 4 years.
Okay.
It allows four years of that time may be purchased.
And Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, and tell me if I'm wrong. I understand it to be only if you are not able to receive a military retirement. So people who've served less than 20 years in the service or whatever it is now to get a retirement, those are the people that this applies to, so that you can use, if you were in the service like I was for 4 years, I could have used up to 4 years of my time. I'm not going to get a retirement from the service just from hopefully the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you bringing us this most interesting issue to us. Next up, Mr. Jim Green, Ms. Beth Ann Darby, and Mr. Brian DeLashmet.
I know, me too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, and I'm here on behalf of the Dash 8 amendments. And Senator Ringo, I will try not to speak in code, but this is a highly technical issue in PERS of dealing with the issue of earned when earned versus earn when paid, and this is important when it comes to retirement for calculation of final average salary. In Tier 1, it is calculated when it earned when paid. Tier 2 and the new OPSERPs of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, i.e. Tier 3, it's earned when earned. This is a huge problem for school districts across the state because we have individuals who work the school year, which is 9 months, but they're paid over an average of 12 months. They average out their paycheck, so it's 12 months. They also have issues with regard to what we call extra duty contracts. A coach comes and coaches football. That season is September, October, November, but they're paid over the 12 months to coach football so that it works with their averaging of their payroll. In Tier 2 retirements and in Tier 3 retirements, it's earned when that money is earned, not when it's paid by the school districts. PERS, in order to calculate final average salary, would require that employer to go back to their timesheets post hence 20 years and try to calculate when those funds were earned, which is becoming a huge nightmare. Representative Tom Butler has heard from the Ontario School District, Chris Panicky, their payroll clerk, about how much of a pain this is for the Ontario School District. They've had two Tier 2 retirees, and they simply don't have the records. And they're trying to find a way to get the records. This will, the Dash 8s will include school districts to have Tier 2 and Tier 3 as earned when paid, community colleges, and the state agencies as well, except for the Oregon University system. According to the Department of Administrative Services, Denise Hall, it's very important for them as well because they have that same payroll issue of earned when earned versus earned when paid. And I would tell you that the Dash 8s do not amend the original bill. The provisions that you just heard about relating to military buyback provision are still in with the Dash 8s. And as to other amendments...
It's opposed to a gut and stuff.
As opposed to a gut and stuff. Okay. It's an add-on. I think, as the chair said, there were many cabooses being added.
Yes.
This is one that, according to our payroll folks in school districts and according to state agencies, they need so that they can have that calculation be correct for retirements.
Okay. Ms. Darby.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, for the record, Beth Ann Darby on behalf of the Oregon Education Association and Senator Ferraioli. I'll just correct, the Dash 1 amendments to this bill were not distributed. They're just the only ones left that have not been identified. And I believe they were the original set, yeah.
but my in the case, Madam Chair, I will ask committee staff to copy and distribute these.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks. My caboose is the Dash 6 amendments, and this has to do with an ongoing problem with part-time employees and the new retirement system, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. By way of background, a part-time employee in the PERS system who worked in excess of 600 hours would receive a year of service for all purposes under PERS Chapter 238. This would include a calculation of when the member would be eligible for 30 and out retirement, as well as calculating his or her pension under the full formula benefit method. In contrast, under the new retirement system, a part-time employee receives only a partial year of credited service for each year in which they work less than full-time. The benefit calculation under OPSERP protects those employees in calculating their defined benefit by making an adjustment in their final average salary so that the benefit calculated as, is calculated as if they worked on a full-time basis. What the Dash 6 amendments do is they allow all part-time employees, well, they allow school employees are not going to be able to accumulate service on a prorated basis, which makes it virtually impossible for them to qualify for the 30 and out provision under OPSERP. As an example, a half-time employee who works 1,000 hours in a 2,000-hour position only accumulates a half year of credited service under OPSERP for each year he or she is employed. Such an employee would have to work a total of 60 years in order to be able to retire at age 58 under the OPSERP plan. And what this does is it does not impact the formula for calculating retirement benefits. It only allows eligibility to be calculated based on a calendar year for part-time school employees.
And, Madam Chair, if I might add, remember, this was an issue that we talked about in House Bill 2189, which was another bill that went back. And you remember I mentioned that to this committee, that we were working on an issue that dealt with requiring Tier 3 part-time folks to work 60 years in order to gain a retirement benefit. Ms. Darby and I have had a meeting of the minds on this issue as it relates to school employees, and we are supportive of the Dash 6 amendments to take care of this for school employees.
Okay. We are supportive of the Dash 8 amendments as well.
All right. Sam Ringel, can you hold your question until we finish Mr. DeLay?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you have just written testimony that everything you just said. No?
I can get you an outline.
Same with Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringel.
In the form, they both said no.
Okay.
So at least they're consistent with the form. Probably a little memo might be helpful. Thank you. Just maybe you could do a memo together and save paper. All right, Mr. Lashman, to confuse us further, you have the dash 10?
Dash 10s, which you have not seen yet.
Okay.
They are still being processed. For the record, Brian Lashman, I represent the caboose in this particular case is on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Association. It's the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. It's an issue dealing with PNF. Let me give you just a slight background. Well into the legislative session, I attended a meeting in Eugene of one of my units, and they supplied me with an email that was from the PERS customer service office that instructed them that there was going to be an administrative rules change dealing with how years of service or calculations of years of service for the ability for a person under PNF to retire that was going to go forward and be implemented in January of 06. I then had conversations with Mr. Delaney, and after it all sorted out, it appears that that administrative rule has not occurred yet, but they are considering an administrative rule, and that's what brought us to this discussion. The administrative rule, or potential administrative rule from PERS, is promulgated, as my understanding, on a letter of opinion from the Attorney General reinterpreting a statute that's been into effect since, I believe Dave Hendricks said, 1973, in which the new interpretation, and if you look, if you were to look at the PERS statute, but let me just read you. It says, a police officer or firefighter who is a member of the system and attains the age of 50. Their new interpretation is that if you have 25 years of service and you've attained the age of 50, but you are no longer employed as a police officer or firefighter, you're not entitled to go out under early retirement. It's a whole new interpretation of what everybody understood has been implemented since 1973 and been in effect since 1973. Upon that, then the PERS Legislative Advisory Committee had a number of discussions, not only about this issue, but also some related issues. And the related issues, and I'll just mention them, and then I'll maybe Steve can go through actually the content of the Dash 10s real quick. But the additional issue of blended service, and if you understand what blended service is, we have officers that have their entire 25 years in PNF, and then we also have some people, whether it's corrections or whatever, that may have part of their service in police and fire and part of their service in general service. And how do you treat those? Are they able to retire at certain ages? And if we were going to look at this particular section of somebody entirely 25 years in PNF, could they or could they not, if they were no longer a police officer or firefighter under this new interpretation, go out? How do we deal with blended service? So we had started having those discussions, and the Dash 10 is a reflection of those discussions. There, I'll give you one caveat. There is still one issue being discussed, and when the Dash 10 actually finally come back, I think we'll have a resolution of that, and it deals with actuarial reductions in one category, one small category of those folks. And with that, I'll leave it to Steve. But
Mr. Laney, you want to kind of respond that cleanup, and then I know Mr. Villarreal would like to testify.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just briefly summarize then what PERS practice is and what these statutes or these amendments are meant to then codify.
Before you do that, Mr. Is it Villarreal? Okay. Did you want to testify about one of the particular amendments?
Yes.
Which one? Ooh, why don't you come up, Mr. Delaney, before you back clean up. Let's get Mr. Villarreal up here.
Okay.
Sorry.
I was hoping.
Don't go anywhere. You're fine.
Okay.
You're fine.
All right, dash sevens.
For the record, Jesse Villarreal, Madam Chair, Senators, wanted to address Amendment-7 in regards to this bill. What we are asking for is that PERS members be given the opportunity to have their monthly contributions to their new individual account program, the IAP, invested in a timely and efficient manner. Currently, what's going on is those monies are being withheld from their paycheck, hold over for 30 days, they've lost the interest and earnings off those monies, and then they get the money credited back, but not the interest and earnings, and not also not the interest and earnings off of the interest and earnings. So they've lost it on two counts, and what we're looking for is to have all interest and earnings contributed in a timely fashion to their individual account program, just like everybody else throughout the country and their retirement plans have. We are also asking that in the June 2004 PERS board meeting, since the individual account program was having so many problems with, to date, still having so many problems with accounting, the board took a vote and voted that due to all the problems, that for the first half of 2004, no expenses on the administration would be charged. What has happened since then is expenses have been charged to members for the first half of 2004 when the board voted no expenses to be charged, and that's on record. So we would like those expenses retroactively given back to members of the individual account program as agreed to by the board. So in summary, contributions credited immediately, interest and earnings, plus the earned amount retroactively credited to members' IAP back to January 2004, then the expenses to be retroactively given back to the participants as well. In addition, we have an example of the expenses on the individual account program, and if I could turn these, give these to you. What I've handed you is a copy of a statement that from a participant of the individual account program, and I've received many of these statements throughout the last few weeks from individuals trying to figure out what's happening to their money. And it is their money that's coming out of their paychecks. As you can see from this example, January 1st, 2004, everybody started off with zero. In this particular instance, this individual had $543.28 worth of contributions withheld from their paycheck. They had received a gain of $39.64, administration fees of $23.13 for a net of $559. Yet, it's stated that the personal investment performance is 10.83%. When we do the math, the actual net increase is 3.038%. So the question is where's the rest of the money? So not only are these people losing the interest and earnings off of their money that should have been credited in a timely fashion, but there's also a huge gap between what the actual performance is and what the performance that's stated on their account. Now, this may seem like just one, but we've got over 150,000 of these that are wrong. And the bigger question is, where is that money and why isn't the participants earning that money and earning interest off of that money? So that's what we would like in dash seven. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Questions for these two guys?
Well, I think the question was, where's the money?
Right. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Delaney and Mr. Clearly. Why don't you both come up? Sort of bat cleanup. Thank you both very much. We appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Delaney, I believe, is going to walk through the dash 10s, and that was the reason why he came up when I was coming up.
Right, but he signed up. He's going to probably respond to all this stuff, is my guess.
Madam Chair.
Sir Ringo.
Can I also ask Mr. Delashmet and Mr. Villarreal to write down, just summarize what you just said? I'd like to understand it a little better. Thank you.
All right. Take it away.
Madam Chair, I'll be brief then, since you'll be getting the testimony on Mr. DeLashmit's Dash Amendment. Basically, the Dash Amendment is meant to codify what Kerr's current practice is, which is that if a PNF officer, police officer, firefighter, who's gone inactive but had completed 25 years of service at, say, age 48, they reach age 50, we presently let them retire. Department of Justice says that may not be the proper way to read statute. His amendment is meant to correct that, along with some other issues, which you'll see in his testimony.
So you're okay with the dash 10s?
We can certainly administer it.
Okay. Because it's current,
It is current practice. We can administer it. I'm cautious in my response because the PERS board has not seen these nor voted on them.
Okay. All right. Do you want to respond to the rest of the amendments in consecutive order, or do you want to take them from the bottom up? How do you want to go?
Could you talk 6 or 4?
Why don't you start at the top? 1, the emergency clause. Any concerns about the emergency clause?
Madam Chair, the emergency clause should not cause an issue.
Number 2, I believe, is the Westland Amendment. Yes.
Number 2, we can administer that.
Okay.
Number 3 is... number 3 we are opposed to.
Okay.
Number 3 is our old Senate Bill 111 together with the judge member benefit increase. We're only opposed because of the problem it's been causing, our 111 language, which is a tax qualification language.
Okay. We don't have it in front of us.
Yeah. Madam Chair, is anybody proposing the Dash 3?
Not at this point in time.
Okay. They're saying no.
Okay.
The Dash 4 is when the PERS itself is moving forward.
Oh, you have your own amendment.
We have our own, which is what we're signed up. Which is the language from Senate Bill 111, the PERS board's original language, along with Senate Bill 110. 111 simply clarifies PERS is one plan with component programs, so that PERS can move dollars around, employer dollars, to meet liabilities where they may accrue. It's been held up on the House side because of the judge member benefits having been added into that bill. We're trying to take out just our tax qualification language, which had passed through the Senate at a vote of 27-0. 5, I have not seen.
Dash 5.
Okay.
Those are not in the file.
Okay, so then Dash 6, is that Mr. Villarreal's?
Dash 7? No, those are...
Okay. People are claiming them in the back. Okay. Dash 6 is the part-time issue. Again, we can administer it. The PERS board has not taken a position on that one. Dash 7 was Mr. Villarreal's.
If you could back up just a little.
Oh, absolutely.
There's 150,000 of these things, according to what Mr. Villarreal has said.
No, we're on Dash 7.
Yeah, we're still on Dash
7. Oh, I'm sorry.
We've reached that one, Senator.
Thank you. Move forward.
And this is where a deputy director gets to turn to his director and allow his director to take the tough issues.
Oh, Dash 7.
Yes.
Okay. Individual count program.
Hi.
I'm looking at
your name.
My name is Paul Clary, executive director of PERS.
Behind door number 2.
Which one's
where's
door
the,
number 2?
Where's
are you
the
talking
money?
About?
Clary.
The money is there. And as a matter of fact, and I believe Mr. Viriel came in maybe a little late to our board meeting, but we've got posted our agenda items from our last board meeting where we outlined our remediation program for the IEP program. And obviously the number one goal is that the members receive all the earnings that they would have received had this program operated the way it was designed from day one. You know, one of the challenges that we faced was trying to implement a new program in a 4-month period that most states say, you know, you want to take at least 18 months to work on this. We've got 775 different employer reporting units using 40 different payroll software systems, and trying to link all of that up into the PERS computer system is quite a challenge. But we do have the ability and the money and the direction from the board to make everything right. Now, you might recall that the legislature directed us to set up this program and set it up separately from Tier 1, Tier 2 accounts with the idea that it would carry its own costs. So there are administrative costs associated with this program, and when you start with account balances of zero, those administrative costs, because a lot of them are fixed costs, can be pretty substantial, particularly in the startup period of a new program. So you will see expenses on these accounts that, as the balances grow, will be a smaller and smaller percent of those balances. Now, you know, I'm willing to work with our board on other ways to deal with administrative costs. What we do in Tier 1, Tier 2 is we deduct those off the top like we do our investment costs, and the investment costs are deducted off the top on this as well. And that's one way to deal with it. But still, you're spreading those costs over very small accounts. These accounts all started at zero. Unlike Tier 1 that's got $7 billion in it, the Tier 1 regular account, you throw another, what we used to do was throw another $170 million or so a year into that from member contributions, and we spread the cost against the entire balance. Here you're spreading cost against an account that started at zero and probably should have accumulated somewhere between around $350 million or so over the course of an 11-month period. What I'm looking at here in this particular statement, not knowing the salary figures or anything, this looks like a statement from a member that probably had at most a couple of months of contributions posted. And you see in the fine print, and they always say, you know, the difference between education and experience is the fine print, but the fine print here is 2004 contributions may not have been added to your account prior to December 1, 2004. Those contributions will be included in the 2005 balance. We have, since these statements have gone out, or actually since the close of calendar year 2004, closed down the number of accounts that didn't have proper contributions to about 3,000 out of a total of around 175,000. And if I remember right, I can't guess this, I think it was less than $200,000 out of a $350 million. So we've got the accounts reconciled. The issue is, what about the earnings? Had my money been in the entire year, or for some people, they actually did better not having it in until August, and then they bought at a very opportune time in the market. Our objective is going to be to go back, restore the rebuild the accounts the way they should have been with the contributions, and then go to an annual crediting mode to where we deal with this issue that I believe Mr. Viriel is trying to deal with through this amendment, and that is, it's not so much the contributions, it's the earnings question. You want to put this money to work as quickly as possible, and we put it to work immediately. It goes into short-term earnings until we can post it into member accounts. If the market's in a loss period, there's actually more money available in the short term, because that's all cash investments, than had been invested otherwise. But our goal, obviously, is restore the accounts the way they should have been developed, and then going forward, administer this in a basis that works for the members, works for the employers, and works for the agency as well.
Questions from the panel? Senator Shields.
As I look at this sheet, it has the administrative fee, you know, the 2313 in there. It looks big because the balances are small, so one thing is set.
Right.
Would it also be true that after the startup time, where this is all new and you're working kinks out, you get better at doing this, and this will go down for another reason, that, like getting the plane off the ground, takes a little more fuel than once you're in the air and flying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, we certainly expect that. Obviously, we've got some startup costs that are one-time costs. Now, yes. I think a legitimate question, and one that I've asked my staff to look at, is have we properly amortized those costs? Or are we front-end loading them to where somebody who, you know, in the first 4 years, we're going to try and pay off all these fixed costs that should maybe have been spread over 10 or 15 years? So we'll look at that question.
That's a good
point. And make adjustments. Some of this is our third-party administrator, City Street. Theirs is kind of a fixed cost. They bid it at $11 an account per year. The rest of the costs are PERS administrative costs. We can look at how we amortized ours.
Mr. Chair, I think you understand my point.
Right.
I'm hoping that it's not only that it looks big in relation to the small balances, but they'll get better at doing what they're doing over time, and it'll actually bring the actual cost of administering it slowly down.
Right. our intent certainly is to minimize the administrative costs. Now, one of the cost features is how often do you make a buy? And what we've done is a monthly buy. And this amendment would basically force us to go to a daily buy. And Treasury, in other words, right now we accumulate the money for a month, we're bringing it in, we're cleaning up the records, we're making sure that when we post it, we don't have to back it out because it's for an ineligible member or it's an erroneous contribution. And then we make the buy. If we go to a daily buy, there'll be more expenses on the money management side, and we'll try to get that figure for you from Treasury. I know that I wasn't here when they originally entered into this contract, but that was one of their considerations, was we could do it. You could buy it monthly, you could buy it weekly, you could buy it daily, but the more frequent the buys are, the more expensive it is.
Mr. Chair.
Hello.
I noticed the shaking of a certain head when you said it forces you to a daily buy, and I don't understand why.
Well, if we credit the contributions into the accounts the way we've been doing it on a unit value basis, then we have to buy it. We have to do a daily purchase, or we have to get a strike price every day that we buy. And with 775 employers sending in money at different times, we probably would be getting money that we'd have to post in that time period.
Senator Atkinson, you had a question or a comment?
Two. You keep saying, Director, you keep saying cleanup of the IAP account.
Right.
What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, by cleanup, what I mean is going in and saying, we know that these members had contributions of this amount on their behalf or coming out of their paychecks. They know it. They see their pay stub. Does their account balance reflect what their contributions were, and then were they appropriately credited with earnings or losses, because we've had some losses as well over the time that they've been in that account?
So that initiative is under your direction?
Right.
And when do you think that will be?
With the board's direction. What we're doing right now is we're developing the estimate of, if this thing had run the way it was supposed to, how much money would have been earned. And then we'll go back in and make the adjustments to the accounts. And what we're looking at doing, Senator, is a 2-year period, because we're already into 05. So we're going to correct 04 and 05 at the end of this calendar year, and then going forward not get into this same mistake.
How quickly is money that a contribution is made? Once a contribution is made, how quickly is that put to work on behalf of the individual?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkins, it's put to work immediately. As soon as money comes in for us, we put it to work. Now, understand, when I say that, it goes into the short-term earnings until we make our monthly strike price and our buy. The short-term earnings are used to defray administrative costs of this particular program, and I believe over the 18-month period up through May, we'd earned about $700,000 in that. Again, you're talking just about cash investments, 1.5% return or so. But as soon as we make the monthly purchase. So the money's invested immediately. We don't stuff money into mattresses. As soon as it comes into us, it immediately is electronically transferred to Treasury and is invested immediately.
Okay. I'm going to try to characterize what I heard, and then if necessary, we'll bring Mr. Villarreal.
Okay.
First of all, I heard that the agency indicated that it would not be charging administrative fees in 2004, and yet those fees are showing up on the statements. So is there an authority to charge the administrative fees, and have we charged those appropriately, or is there no authority to charge the fees, and we've charged them inappropriately?
Mr. Chair, there's a mandate to charge the fees. It's a statutory mandate that we recover the costs of this program through deductions from earnings or fee assessments. So we've got a mandate to do it. I believe what Mr. Viriel is talking about.
Let's speculate. Let's ask him what he's talking
okay.
about. Okay. Second question. Mr. Villarreal indicates that the math is wrong. you disagree that the math is wrong on the statement?
Mr. Chair, he is talking about the personal investment performance calculation.
Yes.
That's an annualized return. If this was in for 1 month and had that kind of earnings, it could very well be that annualized return. But what I'd like to do is give you City Streets. This is a calculation from City Street. This isn't a PERS calculation. I'll get you that information on how they calculate personal investment performance.
Mr. Clary, I think that as long as the document comes from PERS, the communications come from PERS.
Right.
So I don't know whether or not a third party has a responsibility, but if the stated earnings are 10.83%, then I believe that that's what the account should be credited with.
Mr. Chair, again, remember, this is a personal investment performance based on how long the money was in the account.
I understand the annualization of a quarterly statement or a monthly statement extrapolated. I'm just saying the math should add up. If I looked at the earnings and divided the gain by the base of the total in contributions, it wouldn't be 10.83%.
Right.
So I'm just saying perhaps the statement ought to reflect that these are partial year earnings or annualized average. Yeah. They don't say that. It just says your personal investment performance is 10.83%. Clearly it isn't in this example.
Right. Mr. Chair, with the statement, there was an explanation, second page on this, that directed people to calculation of personal investment performance. But I will tell you, again, this is a calculation from City Street. I'm not happy with the fact that no one can do the math on it.
Okay. Well, I think that's causing some confusion
from
the owners of these accounts. I'm not sure I characterized Mr. Villarreal's questions accurately, but it was about the ability also to credit the earnings to the individuals. And if the interim earnings are put in a money market at 1 or 1.5%, whatever happens to be out there for cash funds, and all those dollars are ending up as administrative overhead costs for PERS, or are they actually being credited as earnings to the account?
Mr. Chair, when they calculated how much would the monthly fee be, they calculated in how much we earned in the short-term account. So if you said that your administrative expenses were $3 million for PERS, and you took $700,000 off the top of that because that's what you projected you were going to earn in the short term, then you divided the 2.3 by the months in the accounts in order to come up with a monthly fee. So it was, again, spread back in an attempt to reduce the monthly fees by basically crediting that to the overhead. You're right.
So I guess in the simplest term, you could actually say that the owners of the accounts didn't earn anything in the short term because those dollars were eaten up in administrative expenses.
It defrayed what would have been their administrative expenses. So you can you could increase the monthly fee and put the earnings elsewhere, or you could apply the earnings against the administrative expenses and decrease the monthly fee.
At the request of one of the committee members, I'm going to ask Mr. Villarreal. And, Mr. Clary, rest easy.
No. I'm looking forward to seeing what he's got here on that June action.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just want to support what you said about this, the personal investment performance. You know, I just think the people that are receiving these need to be able to understand what that means. And rather than have a definition of personal investment performance that is so complex people don't get it, relabel it something else so that people can understand what it means. So that hopefully this is meant to be meaningful to people. That's why we produce it, so that it is meaningful. And if that means you have to redefine one of these terms, then let's redefine it so that it is useful.
Thank you, Senator. I have difficulty. For instance, if you drive by on some of the streets in the city of Salem, you'll see savings and loan institutions that offer a 7-month CD at 4.5% interest. That is not an annualized, or that is an annualized, but if you do the math, you're not going to get 4.5% in 7 months.
Right. That's
over a year.
That's right.
And I think the annualization does become a stumbling block for some people. I know it does for me. So, Mr. Villarreal, I tried to characterize and then I corrected myself. Maybe if you could just restate your three concerns about the statement for the record.
I for the record, Jesse Villarreal, and I sincerely appreciate the opportunity.
Can I just ask who you represent?
I started a company called Purse Help 3 years ago, and it was due to my father, who is a very smart, capable guy. He retired as a fire marshal, and he had two major complaints about PERS. One, that every time he called, he got a different answer from PERS for his question, which is common knowledge throughout the state. And number two, he felt that he was being nickel and dimed to death to find out how much money he had in his account.
So you are, your profession, your occupation is analyzing PERS and then helping PERS.
For almost the last 20 years, I've managed money on an individual and on a corporate basis, so I've got almost 20 years in retirement plans, setting up retirement plans and understanding not only state law but federal law as well in regards to retirement plans.
Okay.
And what would be competitive and where the value is when you're looking at expenses. And on a federal basis, going back to your example of a savings and loan, by law you're supposed to state the lowest yield that the calculation puts out. Whether you have three different ways to calculate it, by law you have to state the lowest actual yield that the person is receiving. I have a copy of the information that City Street provides in calculating the personal investment performance. It says, how is it calculated? Since the calculation involves all the activity in your investments throughout the quarter, the calculation is very complex. And then it goes on from there. It doesn't answer how they calculate the numbers. But the bottom line is we still have people that are trying to make informed investment decisions, and they're believing the information that they're receiving in writing, and it's not accurate. And when you go and you look at the material to find the homework, it's buried. And I've been doing this full-time for the last 3 years, and I requested this information. What I finally did was 6 weeks ago, I sent over 15 very detailed questions to PERS, trying to get an explanation of where is the money going. It took 4 or 5 weeks to get responses back, not questions, or not answers, but responses back to my questions. In looking at this information that they responded with, we have, it says PERS also receives, it says how much do PERS and City Street receive in actual dollars and on a percentage basis relating to the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan? Through May 31st, City Street has received a total of $2.3 million in change in administrative fees. PERS has received $2.9 million in change for an aggregate total of almost $5.3 million. IAP account balances, adjusted net assets administered by City Street total about half a billion dollars as of June 3rd. It goes on to talk about it. It says, PERS also receives earnings from short-term investment on IAP contributions before they are posted to individual accounts and uses those earnings to offset administrative expenses. Through May 1st, 2005, PERS received a total of $690,000 in change in such short-term investments. So you've got, those are the earnings, but the other question is, what about the principal? How much money did the principal, how much is the principal that generated that kind of earnings? And why isn't that principal and that $700,000 back in the individual's account where it should be? In regards to daily purchases, paychecks, the contributions from paychecks aren't done on a daily basis. They're done on a monthly basis, or sometimes on a semi-monthly basis. So you wouldn't be doing purchases on a monthly basis when contributions are being withheld on a monthly, daily basis, when contributions are being withheld on a monthly basis. It doesn't make sense. You wouldn't do it. You're only getting it when it's being taken from the paycheck, period. That's the only time that you would do it. In regards to 875 public employers statewide that are feeding into this system, in examining public employer retirement systems over the last 3 years, I've had an opportunity to examine at least a dozen other states that have public employer retirement systems. Oregon is by far the poster child of retirement plans, but we're not alone. And there's things that we could do. What has happened here is...
You just have to... Poster child in terms of complexity, in terms
of... Complexity, in terms of runaway expenses, in terms of no value for the participant. It's common knowledge that people will call in getting different answers to the same question, and they could call in three times a row and talk to three different people. And what we're trying to do is to enable people to make informed decisions with their life savings. That's all we're trying to do. And the only thing that continues to happen is the plan continues to get more and more complex. So what we would like to do is try to simplify it again so that if there is indeed money being withheld from an individual's paycheck and it's supposed to be going into their account, then it should be going into their account. FERS also receives towards administration, just to give you an idea of some of the money that we're talking about. For example, for 2004, the Oregon Investment Committee says that they received 14.47% on all the money within that PERS plan and the SAFE plan. From that 14.47%, FERS board then doles out how much Tier 1 regular account get. They got 8%. The variable account received 12.96%. The Tier 2 account got between 12.34 and 13.34, right in that range. Then the IAP account, coming from the same bucket of 14.47%, gets 3%. Now, you could say, well, it depends on how City Street calculated it out. The bottom line, that individual only has 3% more money. So we've got that gap between 14.47 and 3%, number one. Then we've also got the money from the professional portfolio managers that the Oregon Investment Council uses. Now, if you were looking at other states or private accounts, 401ks, for example, the portfolio managers, for the right to manage that money, they'll contribute money towards administration and expenses, statements, online access, answering questions, and so forth. No money is currently going for that. So the question there is, where are those soft dollars going? The revenue sharing dollars, where are those dollars going? We've got the PERS cost of $1.45 per member per month. We've also got the third-party administrator's cost from City Street, at least $11 per member per month. When you add up those costs, we're looking at almost 1%, 0.984%. When you look at the value being received for that 0.984%, it's dismal. When you look at other plans throughout the country, the expense should be a third of that. And for that expense, it should include statewide education and a variety of funds for people to select the amount of risk that's appropriate for their individual circumstances. With the IAP, the way it's set up, they don't have any choice whatsoever over the amount of risk. It's all one pool, which should drive the cost down dramatically because you don't have an investment choice. Not receiving education unless they pay for it, and it's at least $29. But to receive education on the individual account doesn't do you any good because you have no investment choice. You just have to stick it out. We also have expense going for the Retirement Information Management System, and in the last 2.5 years, it's at least $30 million. Now, when you go back and look at the minutes, it's nowhere in the minutes. You have to attend the meetings to pick that up. And then we've also got money that's going for the new system, jClarity. So we've got 8 different items that are being charged for and the only person that's really getting hit is the PERS member himself, where they've got no benefits whatsoever to this plan, but they're being nickeled and dimed all over the place. And then when you ask detailed questions, you get roundabout answers, and when you look at what City Street is providing, it offers no help whatsoever. So the PERS member is back to where they started from, lost, confused, frustrated, and no help in sight. So,
Mr. Villarreal, that's 3 years of information condensed into 10 minutes of testimony, and it's a bit like drinking from a fire hose. You've got Amendment 7, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
It's a single line, and it says that the board shall credit the contributions to the employee account immediately upon receiving the contribution.
Yes, sir.
I think what needs to happen is that Mr. Clary will have an ample opportunity to go over the last 10 minutes of testimony. I have every reason to believe that we will be taking this issue up again in the near future. I'd like to turn now to other members of the public who might like to testify on this bill, make sure they have an opportunity to testify, and look forward to additional opportunities to hear other folks. And I'm sure we'll have the director and his assistant back. Perhaps they can deal with some of the issues that you put on the record.
Thank you very much.
Is there any other person here present who wishes to tell? Doesn't surprise me. Are there any city members of the committee that wish to make a statement other than good evening?
Have a nice evening.
Thank you. My instructions from the chair are to go ahead and continue till this panel had finished its testimony and then adjourn for the evening.
And then adjourn.
We are in adjournment.
Oh.